So everybody's tired, right? Everybody's exhausted. Everybody was up all night. Whoo! I'm not going to do basically any politics talk today because that's not why you're here. You're probably looking for a little bit of a break. You probably just wanted to zone out. So that's cool. I'm not going to get into it. But yeah, that was one hell of a night. And now it's looking like it's going to be one hell of a week. And yeah, man, I just sat there. Basically, my night went from pouring one glass of wine, saying, I'm just going to take this in casually and try to distract myself and walk away from this, and it's going to be cool, and I'm not going to pay that much attention. And I was a little optimistic early about the way that I wanted things to go, and then it's this roller coaster ride, and then all of a sudden, you know, that one glass of wine turned into, oh man, no more glasses of wine, go to sleep. It's really late. All of a sudden, I'm watching Joe Biden break through at, you know, 12:30. I'm waiting for a media conference, which looked like it was held at one of those stand-up comic venues where they do the drive-in shows. And yeah, I just think that a lot of us are dragging ass this morning. So I'll do my best to try not to focus on that. We got a lot of great guests today. I got Justin Bourne coming on for an hour. We're going to shoot it about his latest column on the NHL. I got some dumb Masters thoughts for him. And also, he's kind of the king of bailing, and someone just bailed on me in the hardest way, so I need him to weigh in on that. We've got John Morosi. Man, Trevor Bauer, just teasing everybody, Trevor Bauer. You gotta chill with this. This is just getting too many people's hopes up. But yeah, he's on Twitter, so I'm going to talk to John Morosi about that. Robert Mays about the NFL trade deadline. Ariel Helwani, my guy, coming on to discuss a few things, a few major moves around UFC, around MMA. And then Howard Beck, because the NBA, honestly, the NBA is probably the biggest story today, sports-wise. And I'm burying it a little bit until 11:30 when I talk to Howard. But it's getting weird, man. It's getting weird. Something seems to be lost in translation for me here a little bit with what's going on with the NBA, because it's a business, and it really feels like there is a huge lack of communication with the players as to exactly how serious the business ramifications have been for them over the last year and how serious the outlook is for them moving forward if they decide not to play in December. So we'll talk to Howard about that, and we'll break it down a little bit more. I can tell you this, though. I can tell you one thing definitively about last night, because like we're all waiting for results, and we're all waiting to see, hey, what's going to happen, is that we all like John King, right? We're all in on that. We like seeing this guy use this telestrator, use the board. It's electric television, right? No matter what, you're just watching the percentages change, and this guy is showing you every county in America. How does one guy know every county in America? This has got – I used to be impressed because Mike Mayock knew all the prospects in the NFL draft and think, wow, no, how – that's got to be the most impressive feat on television. Now it's clearly John King. I guess he spends all 4 years just drilling the board. But the one thing I can tell you for certain is it felt like there was this real shift last night of going online. And the biggest thing that we were going off of for all of this was Vegas odds, was gambling odds, was different sites showing us what the percentages were and what the odds were. And I really do feel like this was an actual tipping point. I texted it to Justin Bourne, who's going to jump on with me now, last night, that it was a tipping point, that it was as tipping pointy gets in terms of making gambling vernacular common household terminology. Like, people know, I think anyways, or a lot more people know now, what gambling verbiage is and how to read a line, which is weird, because we feel like we're in this moment where sports gambling is becoming more and more and more of a thing, and it's becoming more and more a part of just how we consume sports on a regular basis and how we absorb a lot of different things, but that we were looking online to see odds makers and what they were doing with the election and giving it more credence, or a lot of us were giving it more credence than traditional news sites, I thought really said something about where we're going here. Justin Bourne from Hockey Central, who's waiting on the line, walking his son to school, like the good dad that he is, coming through for me. What's up? How was the drop-off? Emotional? Was it good? Were you tired?
No,
did your son have theories for you today on the walk to school? Like, Dad, why are clouds? And you're just, I got 4 hours of sleep last night, son. Please not today. Just go to school.
I swear to God, there's like a thing where I turn into like 1960s dad, where like kids are to be like seen and not heard at certain times, and like today was one of those days. Like I do not care for his opinion. Daycare drop off, I guess JK. So school drop off today was extremely satisfying. You know, basically threw him in there like I was punting a rouge into an end zone or something.
Yeah.
Just get out of here.
Yeah. Good.
So I could get here to talk to you about betting markets and presidential races.
Yeah, definitely. You just made me realize how annoying I must have been as a high school student preaching all my political views to my parents as I couldn't vote. And they're like, yeah, no, for sure. No, it's a great observation. You read one book. You read a Michael Moore book, and now you know everything about American politics. That's great. No, we're thrilled to have you in this household.
You know what? Like, great. If I'm a parent, I'm like, all right, at least he's taking an interest. He's trying. Yeah. I'm going to support this. But, like, seriously, shut up.
Yeah, that's good. You read a book. Okay, yeah. Now go read another book, and we'll talk after that one, maybe. Just like maybe the bar should be
many
two
books.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the fact that you are so stupid that you think this one book has all the answers that you needed, she's kind of telling you where we're at here. So, yeah, I do want to just start with the gambling thing quickly because, yeah, you wrote this really good article on what the NHL is going to look like, and it really resonated with me because there were a couple of things I had thought of and then a couple of things that I really hadn't, and I want to bounce through some of those things. And then, of course, the Masters are next week, and we'll probably get you on before that. I'm looking at doing a segment maybe where we'll do our picks and we'll do some theories.
Yeah.
But I want to try and squeeze all this in. So let's get to the gambling.
Yeah,
do you feel the same way I do? Like, okay, I'm sorry, but that was a major story of last night, was just how people were texting me, and I know that I'm a gambling guy, so I don't know if it's an echo chamber thing a lot of times, right? Because sports Twitter involves a lot of gambling, and so that's permeating my feed. But I had people who were not gambling people or not necessarily sports people texting me, well, the odds are this now, and the odds have tilted for Trump, and the odds have gone this way. And gambling has always had this thing around it, right? And about the stigma that comes with it, right? And it kind of felt like a moment where, I want to say it's very similar to pot, where people basically, there's some people who thought it was the worst thing. There's some people who just felt it was completely normalized. But then there was this shift with pot where everybody just kind of got on board and said, okay, well, hey, this is what it is. We're going to make it legal. It's going to get taxed. There's more benefits to having this be legal than illegal. And I really did feel like last night was a moment for gambling, like a real moment in North America for its legitimacy.
Yeah. Well, you know what really stood out to me last night was I follow, as you do, I'm sure, Aaron Bronstetter. Bronstetter? Am I saying that right?
Bronstetter.
The MMA gentleman. And he talked about watching the odds in the 2016 election and how, you know, Hillary Clinton was the favorite, Trump the underdog, and then every 15 minutes you could see that switch. And he said you can see the point at 9:15 p.m. in 2016 where the odds went to Trump and never went back. Well, last night it happened again. At 9:15, the odds flipped to Trump being the favorite, and I kind of had this sinking feeling in my stomach just that, like, is it possible that all of the polling and 538 and Nate Silver and New York Times, all of it is just less effective than the betting markets and where people are comfortable putting their money? And I'm not sure that that held true, because at one point last night, Trump was a minus 600 favorite on a certain website.
Blip, though.
It was a blip. Our buddy, Coolbet Chris there at Coolbet Chris, was telling us, like, at some point books are overexposed and need to protect themselves and to get some bets on the other side to sort of even the risk out. So you have to kind of keep that in mind when you're looking at the betting odds, but they do tell a story that it ends up being scarily accurate.
Yeah. I know that they were flipping and they were going all over the place. So I don't know. Maybe that's counter to it. Maybe that's made people go, hey, this means nothing. Because I think on Coolbet right now, I just saw them do a tweet that Biden's something like minus 286. But the fact is, I can say minus 286, and I think that people are hanging with me and understanding relatively what that means right now.
I wish it was
like, I don't need
speak.
to, Right, but I know that some of you, like, that's the Canadian way of betting, I think, is that a lot of Canadians use decimals and they think it's better, and I've never understood that, but whatever. It's just basically you got to bet $286 to win $100 profit, and that's what Biden is. He's a sizable favorite right now after being all over the map last night. And again, But that's what I mean. I can't decide if last night was good for the way that we're going to follow elections, which is through gambling, because there still is, when I talked about that stigma, there is something that still felt a little gauche, right? Even to me, someone who loves gambling, thinking, hey, this is serious. I don't know. I kind of want the pundits weighing in here. I want credible news sites. It also was a bit of a state of where news media is at to a certain degree of its effectiveness, its reporting, and its bias, where I thought, okay, I do trust the gambling markets more than anything. I trust the gambling markets more than your show. Sorry, but I do. And I'm looking at this saying, well, are you telling the full story here? Because the gambling guys are saying a little bit different. The odds makers are saying something different. But yeah, just in terms of where we are going with sports betting and where – like this has been obvious, right? The pandemic has hit and there's going to be more places looking to try to grab money, to try to make up for things. The gambling lobbies are powerful. They're big. They're huge. And I just think we're right there. We've been on the doorstep for a while, but now that this is just a complete breakthrough. And I think that the way that we consume sports, it's actually going to start to be hard not to see the gambling influence. Like, it's going to be hard to find broadcasts where this isn't brought up. You know when it used to be you watch Monday Night Football, and if someone made an insinuation about gambling, that it was like, ooh, spicy. That was a spicy little nugget. Now I think it's going to be the opposite, where you're going to have this weird transition where sports fans are all going to feel like, do we have to gamble? And the answer is absolutely not, but I don't know really. I do think that this is where we're tracking. Everything is going to have something.
I think what's good about this is I think it makes broadcasters take a stance. You know, it puts you in a camp in terms of prognostication. It's been really easy for a long time when you're not talking about gambling to say, I don't know, both teams are pretty good, you know, or to like kind of, you know, hedge your bets. If this happens, then I think that will happen. You know, one thing that talking about gambling with sports does is it makes you say, well, what do you actually think? Where would you be comfortable putting your money in terms of, you know, are they going to win by 7 points? Are they going to? I really like that it creates a sort of a clarity in opinion, which, let's be honest, part of why we consume sports media is to set the parameters for expectations. You know, we go into a series. What should happen in the series? What do we think is going to happen? And then you wait to see if that does, and you know what to look for a little bit. So I think sports betting conversation helps us sharpen that a little bit. You're right. You certainly don't have to, but I think it's still, even if you're not betting, I think it can help tell the story. Golf, by the way, which I know we're going to get to, is one of the sports that is leaning heavy into sports gambling. I can't remember 2 years ago where it was mentioned, and now they'll have updated like leaderboards throughout the weekend of the changing odds of the players in contention. So that's a fascinating one for me.
I'm of two minds with this because, one, I actually do think that with gambling and those stakes that you mentioned, that when you're talking about sharper analysis with predictions, that is going to become a reality, that you're going to have to come prepared when you're deciding to make picks, right? That, hey, the stakes are going to be a little bit higher for what you do. People are going to be more vitriolic towards you if you get them wrong, because that happens always. It doesn't matter if you're just saying, hey, here's my opinion, follow it at will. It's no one's, you know, forcing you, no one's telling you to do this, but this is what I'm doing, this is how I'm playing. There is a little bit more added pressure, which means that you end up doing more homework. So yeah, I think that's an ancillary benefit. But I also know that with the stakes being higher, I wonder where we're going to draw the line in terms of our analysts who do this, and whether it's just going to be commonplace for everyone to do it, or there's going to be a small faction of people who don't, like the ones who can vote for awards, that they don't get to be the ones who do this, and then everybody else is game, and who gets this. Because I know how I need to – I do avoid gambling on the local teams unless it's very, very low stakes. Like if it's a Blue Jays playoff game like this year, for example, I don't touch that because I don't really want anything clouded by that added emotion that comes from the gambling. Right?
Yep.
Totally it does. And so, you know, I've had games where, you know, you bet a total or you bet for a local team or you bet against them, and it sours you in a way that makes you a little bit different in your approach. Even when I've had some tweets about some stuff that I haven't gambled on, I've had people reply like, oh, you had money on this or something. I'm like, actually, I didn't. But I don't like that element of it. Like, I don't like that element of gambling where you have to question basically someone's motives. You have this added layer of questioning the people who talk about sports and who you enjoy listening to or watching and or reading, having the lens colored a little bit by whether or not they won or lost money. And it's funny because you can say, well, how much you betting? It's not very much. It should be inconsequential. But that's the point, is that it feels like no matter – I've even done this test where you can gamble very little on a game, and if you feel like you got snake bit, you're going to be pissed off about it no matter if you have $5 on it or $105 on it. You know, it's
That's a good question, JD. Then why are you betting is I think something to assess. And for me, like, I don't think that I am this, you know, sports prognosticator that is that much ahead of the market. I'm someone who is in tune, particularly with hockey, but with most sports. And I feel like, you know, in general, I am a plus better to this moment, but I'm not getting rich doing it. And that's not why I do it per se. For me, it's about my investment in games that I wouldn't otherwise be invested in changes.
Same.
And my enjoyment. I enjoy games. Oh, I'm watching the Cubs Cardinals game in, you know, the middle of the season. It's like, all right, I'm in. You know, I have stakes. So I try not to bet much on things that I'm already invested in.
Yeah, I'm the same way. You know what I really enjoy more than anything is just the ritual of going back to college, of being with my roommates and talking through what we liked this week and going in and out and trying to analyze things. And it really is still a way for me to stay in touch with friends, right? Like, I still call my college roommates each Sunday. I still call my brother on Sunday. We hash out our favorite picks. We discuss, we debate, you know, we rub it in each other's faces when one's wrong and doesn't come with somebody, or when someone's right and you don't come with their pick. It's I really do enjoy that ritual. I enjoy those discussions. You're right. I like the added juice. I like that feeling. Especially for casual games. I do try to avoid the ones that are local for the most part, even though I'm always torn as to whether or not I know those are the ones I should be or those are the ones I'm not. But either way, like, I guess unless you want to say something else, I really did feel like last night was a tipping point in terms of the legitimification. Is that a word? Legitimization?
Yeah, sure.
That's it. No, yeah. I think the legitimization of of gambling talk, and just that people are going to look at that more like, hey, this is happening. This is an inevitability. This is coming down the pipeline, and it's already been happening. There's already been a huge groundswell, but yeah,
Before you turn the page on this, JD, the only thing is, where do you stand on my idea, my concept of the happiness hedge? Like, if I want a team to win badly enough, like, let's say Raptors game 7, I will absolutely bet against the Raptors. So if they lose, at least someone throws me a little money. And if they win, I consider it money well spent.
No, I hate it because I'm really stupid. I'm really, 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 really stupid. And people don't realize how stupid I am. But
well, most of us do.
I know, yeah. If you know me, you know, right? If you know me, you know. Like, hey, is that the guy who didn't pee for 6 innings during a Blue Jays playoff game when he really had to because he felt the pee was lucky? Yes, that's him. He's a stupid guy. Like, he's really dumb. But I honestly feel like there are times, and again, this is all just confirmation bias, but if I bet on the team, you know, when I'm rooting for someone, or if I do the happiness hedge, that now the gambling gods are going to be like, you used up a thing here, you know, like this goes in the bucket, this goes in the kitty, and now we're going to pay you out.
Imagine the vanity, JD.
I know the vanity of thinking you matter. I know. I do. And that's the problem, is that I know I'm scum. I know I'm trash. And yet there's this other part of me somewhere in my brain that's always like, you're the most important thing. You're tilting everything in the universe. And I think a lot of us have that. Everything you do has meaning.
Nothing you do is wasted energy. Yeah. That's not – I don't think you're alone in that department. I think a lot of us like to – we're all the main character in our own plays.
Again, I blame my mom. I love her to death, but I totally blame her. Just, you're so special. You're so great. You're so special. I love you. It's just like, yeah, how could she be wrong? I trust her more than anyone. She's the smartest lady I know. If she's saying it, and she's been saying it since day one, her message has always been clear and consistent.
Unwavering.
That I am special. I am smart. I am unique. And so I'm just – I'm sorry. I'm going with the lady that I've literally known since the first second of my life. So I gotta side with her then, rather than you suckers who've known me for like 10 minutes and are tweeting on me online. Okay, so the NHL. Actually, you know what? Let's take a quick break. Let's take a quick break, and then let's come back and hit everything else. We're going to talk about the NHL. We're going to talk about Masters Theories. Hopefully, I hope we can get these in. And then I just had someone bail on me in the absolute worst way, I think, anyways. But again, I'm special and I see everything through my lens, so I need to ask you. That's right. Next on Good Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan with Justin Bourne from Hockey Central. It's a good show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. No Ben Ennis this week. Got Justin Bourne for the hour. I will say this about Ben. I don't give him enough compliments, but he is the master of when to take vacation. Like, if you ever need to consult someone, he could open a consulting firm on what days and what weeks you should take days off. He is incredible at it. Like, the guy's track record extends back years as to when he's off. Those are the most difficult days to do shows. It's a near certainty. You want to do prognostications, you want to talk about gambling, you want to talk about things to bet on, that's the one. He is the vacation king. There is just absolutely no doubt about it. He books it so far in advance, Bourne, you can never even beat him. I thought, oh, this would actually be a good week to take vacation, and I texted our bosses, and they were like, oh, Ben took it a year ago. Like, what?
Yeah.
He knew. He saw the pandemic coming, everything. He was all over it. So, yeah,
this,
Ben's
this
back
is literally the difference in, like, the family thing versus the single guy thing. It's just like he spends way more time just planning, trying to find moments of happiness.
Yeah.
How can he avoid this? I'm not surprised Ben's good at that.
I will say, though, too, it's so... We're in a pandemic where you can't travel and you can't really do much, and he's got two kids. And ooh. I called him the day before. We texted a little bit during the election yesterday because, you know, he follows it pretty closely as well. His wife is American. She actually got to vote in Texas. So everything he's basically outlined for me is, he's having fun and it's nice not focusing on the show, but he's still waking up at 6 a.m. with the boys and he's basically all day babysitter indoors. So it's not exactly like it's the world's most entertaining vacation, I would say.
No. And then he woke up this morning and turned on CNN and it was not John King in front of the board. And he was like,
happening? It was some imposter in front of the board.
Was it jarring seeing that guy?
Yeah, it was. It's funny because I left it on and I'm such a weirdo. I left it on and I wanted to I had my Rogers Ignite on my laptop and I put my laptop next to my bed. I didn't even close it. And I just turned the screen brightness down all the way and muted it. And then this morning I just turned the brightness up to see, and that's the first image I saw this morning was the imposter touching the board and doing the screen. I was like, really? They don't just make John King work through the night? That's
John. You know what? That's funny, though. It looks like John King just Benjamin buttoned back overnight.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like a younger version of him. They're training for this pope that is John King expires eventually.
Yeah, someday that Telestrator guy, that board guy, is going to be the dude. Also, I love the live action shot of the polling stations where they're counting the votes. Like, okay, do we need this?
What does that mean to me?
Yeah, it's like, exactly. Is this to make them work faster? Is this for transparency? What exactly is this for?
I also have one thing before we move on.
Yeah.
Is it true that last night baseball gave out its like gold gloves?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
What are they doing?
No, baseball's really smart. Baseball's a really smart sport. They got to figure
that
it out.
Honestly, that's you know, you criticize the NHL quite a bit. That feels like an NHL move. That is wildly just ignorant.
Yeah. First of all, this is the spin for baseball, though, is that nobody cares anyways. There's no day of the year where they could have put those awards and been like, "Wow, you're really going to dominate."
Because it's not a day? The gold gloves?
No, because the thing is, dude, is nobody watches any teams outside of their own market. That's why it's very similar to hockey that way, except for, I don't know, hockey in Canada, I think that the biggest stars translate a little bit more nationally. Like, you have more chance of watching Connor McDavid on an odd night over the casual baseball fan watching a Mike Trout game, right?
Right.
And defense is just one of those things that, in a sport where... The number nerds will try to tell you this is the value of the defense, but it's very much like I don't buy all of it. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's tough to quantify. And then the other stuff is totally eye test, where you're saying, okay, cool, I think this guy's great, and I think this guy tracks down balls, or this guy's an amazing shortstop. But then when they give it to someone, I just I feel like the difference between some of these guys is very minuscule, and that it's a cool thing to have at the end of your career, X amount of gold gloves. It's more of a statement of who you were as a total player. But year in, year out, I don't think that there anybody really cares about any award, especially since in baseball, even the MVP stuff, it's not like – it's not as fun as other sports where you get to debate it, right? You don't get to debate MVP in baseball. The numbers – and this is part of why that sport is so crap – is – it just, it's no fun to discuss things because the numbers will just say, hey, this is who the MVP is. And even though Mike Trout has not played in a meaningful game ever, he's MVP again. You're like, okay, I guess, if you say so.
It is wild, man. Like, you know, I'm a Jays fan, and I think that's it's common with a lot of baseball fans. I'm a fan of the local team here. But, like, I see tweets come up in my timeline once in a while that's like, yeah, Mike Trout's inarguably the greatest baseball player of all time. He's the greatest, and he's in his prime. They're like, you could go watch the single best player to ever play the sport who is in his prime tonight.
No one cares.
Not doing it.
Not one solitary person cares. Ennis, for 2 years.
Give me Rowdy Tellez. Give me, show me whatever the Jays are rolling out that night over Mike Trout anytime.
Well, yeah. Also, you're spending at a minimum of 3 hours 162 times over the course of a year. It doesn't leave a lot of appetite for other baseball. And I do think that, and maybe this is the way that we can pivot to hockey, is that I do believe this is hockey's problem as well. And here in this country, we have failed to acknowledge that for a little while, and I just think it's becoming more and more a reality as we're noticing trends, whether it be online or television ratings, whatever you want to get at, that people care about their team and that they will invest time with their team. But with all of the content that's out there, with everything that you have competing with the NHL, that it's a tough sell to tell someone, hey, watch the Leafs play 82 times a year, but then also go watch some Western Conference hockey and take your tally of NHL for the night to up to 6 hours. It's just... It's too big of an ask. You're not going to be getting it.
Which is why people, hockey Twitter can be tough sometimes when people are like, you don't appreciate the value of Esa Lindell? And you're I'm sorry, who? I of course, do know the value of Esa Lindell because it's my job,
but
I would not expect anyone else to.
Of course, dude, I work in sports. And do you know how many Dallas Stars I knew once they got to the Stanley Cup where all of a sudden they're trotting dudes out there? I'm like, oh. Yeah. So this is a person, huh? And they're like, this guy's super important to the team. I'm like, that's all right. If you say so, I'm learning of him right now. I'm learning of him in this very moment. And there was all these other sports happening, and fine. But I'm just telling you that I did not know, I want to say 65% of the Dallas Stars. Like, it was a high, really, really high number. Because, again, I'm not watching any Dallas Stars games. But
in fairness, you got, like, the injured version of the Stars by the end, where they're like, here's Joel Kiviranta. And even people like me are like, and that is who?
It's funny that you mentioned him. That was the guy that when they were like, he's been super important. I was like, okay, Kiviranta, cool name. I wonder if your proposal, because you wrote a column, five thoughts about the NHL season, or what's next for the NHL in 2020-21 and beyond. And I love these pieces right now. I like reading them from people like yourself who, really deep dive into it and think about some stuff. I like the stuff on the fans, but I do want to start with just the schedule itself, because there's some reports now that the NHL might not start until February, right? That's out there, that it's not going to start until February. And if it doesn't start until February, I have a hard time seeing the NHL convincing its players to roll through their entire summer, which means that your theory of 55 to 60 games makes a lot of sense if that's the target date. My only thing is this. Do you know what the television deals look like or how they would have to renegotiate that? Because like with the NBA, they have to do 70 deal or 70 games or else they need to renegotiate television rights. And it's one of the biggest reasons for the players to sign the December 22nd thing is because, hey, you've already lost a ton of money. You're going to lose more. But not only that, you have to go back to the table with your TV people and basically have a give back. And the first thing I thought of with 55 to 60 is, okay, so in a league that needs every penny, every cent, and is playing at a loss right now, and has a flat cap and all these different things, if you're eliminating potentially, 25 games from your schedule, 27 games from your schedule, that feels like it's going to have some type of pretty major impact from the TV side, no?
Yeah, that's a good point, and that's maybe something we could follow up with our own people. I'm not exactly sure what the agreement was. I believe the agreement last season was similar to the NBA's, where 70 games was where they had to get to, which is why they called it when they did in the NHL. They probably could have called it a week sooner, but I believe they were stretching it to get to that sort of minimum games played mark. That is an interesting thing. But to your point, like, they operate at a loss without fans in the stands. So
no matter what.
Right. So, you know, by eliminating games, you would think that these owners would not be, you know, have their pocketbooks hurt so much by only playing games starting in February when, you know, operation costs can tick up because hopefully you can have fans. This is the one thing, my takeaway from talking to people about what could come next for the NHL, is that fans are going to be there. And that's something I didn't think was going to be at the start of next season, as recently as maybe a month ago. But fans are going to be there in some capacity. And whether that means seeking out states where the rules are more flexible. You look at the NFL, I think it's different, is it not, state to state, about how many fans are allowed to games?
Yeah. So you watch different games, and you go, like, if you're watching a Dolphins game, you go, wow, it's a full house. And then you watch like Seattle, they have no fans.
Yeah, and so I think it's very possible that, you know, the NHL would seek out a place like Florida to have a hub so that all of the games could have X amount of fans, whatever the number would be at that time, and then do some sort of revenue sharing across teams. They just have to have people at games, and I know that they had talked about having sort of a two-part season potentially, where you would have the first half of the season in hubs, some fans, and hopefully the climate gets better. Maybe there's a vaccine at some point throughout all this, and suddenly you can have more fans and full stadiums, arenas by the end of it, I think is the design.
Yeah, my thing with the vaccine stuff is just, and again, this isn't political, this is just from tracking and trending and watching things and learning from the NBA, because we have this discussion all the time, right? Which is, hey, the NHL should actually be taking lots of lead from the NBA. And that even though sometimes it looks like the times they try to rush out and beat them are the times that they end up kind of looking silly. And this is how I feel about this in a way, which is, okay, the NBA's whole plan is structured around, okay, let's just try and make 21-22 as normal as possible and reap all the revenue back in that season. So that's why they want to start on time. That's why they want to get it done by June. That's why the whole focus is, we don't know, we can't predict with the vaccine, we can't predict with the fans. All of this stuff is so difficult to try and project that let's just do what we can control and adjust accordingly. And I think if the NHL's plan is, well, we could have fans here and we could potentially have a vaccine, and if we're bumping it back and it's shortening your season, that's the stuff where it feels like it could bleed into the following season as well. And that's where I feel like you're counting your chickens before they hatch. And it reminds me a little bit of the OHL thing from last week, which was, okay, I was really pissed off about the no-hitting thing, and I went into my old-school mentality of all this stuff, and then I was reminded that, okay, we're talking about February, and it's November, and oh my God, how much could change? You know, just that all of this stuff, whenever we try to make these predictions, it feels so stupid. And you know, we end up in this place and go, oh, okay, well, all of this was wrong. And so for the NHL, I would just be trying to map out a plan that is as immune to things that are outside of their control as possible. And that relying on anything other than just the stuff that they can control, like stadium dates and potential and having empty arenas and what's the best television product and how do we get as much money in our pockets as possible, all independent of whatever happens with coronavirus. Like, that has to be the plan. We lose Bourne.
Oh, sorry. I was on mute. I absolutely agree with you. I don't know if a lot of these guys have the pocket to sustain a season where they say, let's just get through this one to get back to normal. What I do know is that there one big thing kind of looms over all this, and that's the NHL has to negotiate TV rights, the next TV deal with NBC, the U.S. TV deal. So they need to stay on NBC's good terms, and don't forget, NBC has the Olympics, and the Olympics are supposedly happening in, I guess, June or July of 2021. Yep. So NHL believes they have a hard end date on when they can finish their season. So, you know, it makes sense to me that if you're going to go from February to June for a full NHL season, that you're just going to try to cram it in, finish it off, you know, get that deal done so NBC stays happy. I know with that, the NHL wants to make as much money as possible along the way, but nowhere in this, you'll notice, have I mentioned the integrity of the 2021 season and what that is going to look like. I think that they have other priorities before concerning themselves with things like that.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. Do you think that with less games that people will be more interested in watching more teams? Or how do you see that shaking out just from what we were talking about in terms of the national stuff? Because, yeah, I do feel like less is more in terms of getting people to invest in your team, in your games, that everything is going to have more meaning, that, again, gambling is going to be up. There could be this Canadian division. Do you think that this is actually going to be a boon TV season for the NHL? Because there's a lot of indicators that could say, hey, this could actually really work out for them.
Yeah, particularly here in Canada, I could see that if there is a Canadian division and the stakes are higher with each game for sure. There's also the randomness of hockey. And, you know, last season, if you had checked the standings, I want to say 3 or 4 weeks into the season, the Buffalo Sabres were in first place in the Atlantic Division by at least 5 points ahead of the Boston Bruins and everyone else.
Right.
That's after, like, a number of hockey games. You know, that was, I don't exactly remember how many, but maybe 10, 15 games. You know, in a shortened season, you could have a lot of teams that aren't that great make a push and suddenly become interesting. You would have that variance that the NHL loves, that anyone can win any night. You know, no one's really out of it. Like, you would have drama come playoff time. There would be great pushes that would obviously come very sooner, or, you know, a lot sooner than it would in a normal season. So certainly the stakes could be high. There's potential, you're right, for a lot of eyeballs and interest in these high-stakes games.
Well, I can't help but think, though, too, that if there's a 55 to 60 game season and there's a Canadian division, that you're going to have another play-in scenario. That's going to return the expanded playoff format, maybe not in its exact same iteration, but
that's a good point.
That there's going to be some way of trying to counter the randomness of the year and the way that some clubs are going to be upset, and to try to keep as many markets involved as possible. Like, this is my biggest question, and you brought it up with the Canadian division, and I hadn't thought about it, right? Because I think, like a lot of people, you look at the Canadian division as a fan in this country and say, this is amazing. This is great. More games against Vancouver. More games of the Leafs against Calgary. Build those rivalries up, right? Make Toronto actually care about those other cities, because we've made the joke over and over and over again, but it's very true that in Vancouver, they feel like Toronto is a rival. And in Toronto, you look at it like, I'm sorry, what? Like, what time? You guys play games at 10:30 at night? Don't know anything about you. It's the Don Draper thing. I don't think about you at all. But all of a sudden, if you're playing over and over and over again, you can stoke those rivalries. You can have some fun animus between those fan bases. So I looked at it from that standpoint of saying, okay, well, you're going to make hockey a national sport again. You're going to grow it nationally in this country, because there's going to be just more discourse between fan bases. You're going to have more matchups. You're going to know the players on each team, blah, 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 blah. But I hadn't really thought of the drawbacks, which is what you outlined, the idea of an asterisk, right? If your team actually makes it, and people get to say, well, you only play the Canadian teams, and what if a lot of the Canadian teams are bad this year, and blah, 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 and you get there, and it makes it a really advantageous spot. And that's why I just think you have to have the expanded playoff format, because you can't have a team get a clear path to the postseason. I guess it happens in sports all the time with bad divisions. Like, look at the NFC East here, and you don't get an asterisk. You just say it's a bad division if they win. But I do think that there's some stuff with the all-Canadian division that in a sport like hockey would get picked up on a little bit more if things got weird.
Well, it's just, you know, it's such a silly thing to care about, but, you know, we are in sports talk radio, and for me, it's like,
sure,
a Canadian team is going to break through. The last thing you want to do is to have a Canadian team gifted a path to the conference final, the other team has an injury or two, and, you know, a Canadian team's win a cup in a 48-game season where they didn't have to play an American team until the third round or something. I don't know, I feel like when a Canadian team does break through, I want it to be that they broke through. They built a great team, and they won. And they, you know, they did the whole thing. I want to hater-proof it, and I don't think that's possible with the Canadian division. On the other hand, I don't think the NHL cares. No. I wonder if the NHL would be worried about a lack of interest in some of the other games and markets if all of a sudden you pull the Canadian teams from their division. You know, are they missing out on an element of excitement and engagement?
I don't think they are. I don't think they are. I really because this is my case for it. I thought about this too. NBC Sports does their rivalry night, right? they do rivalry night, and that's always the big ticket item. That's essentially their nationally televised game that they run on NBC. They bring out the big boy panel, and they say, this is the game of the week. And it never involves Canadian teams, because I don't think anybody in the States cares particularly that much about it. It's just they want the same thing, because, again, hockey is very regional, right? If you're a Pittsburgh fan, you want them to beat the Capitals or the Flyers. And so you want to see that on rivalry night. If it's all of a sudden Penguins-Habs, you don't care that that's Sidney Crosby's boyhood team and that, you know, like, that's not a part of your viewing experience. It's not the same way. Like, you're just very, very regional. So if there were a ton of Canadian games during rivalry night, I think there was one time the Leafs were, because we had someone on the show from NBC, and I can't exactly remember how it went, but it was a big Austin Matthews showcase night. And we were talking, trying to basically hype up the idea that this was a breakout moment for Austin Matthews, and does America care about Austin Matthews? And I remember our guest just kind of being like, and I think it was Jeremy Roenick, and he's going, nah, like, nobody here really cares. Nobody really cares about Austin Matthews. They don't think of him like Canadians do with their athletes that are south of the border, right? Like, if you flipped it and Canadians were bad at hockey and we were the I don't want to say America's bad, but if we had an Austin Matthews caliber player playing in, say, you know, for the New York Knicks, right? Because this would be the comparable. Like, we have R.J. Barrett, but let's say R.J. Barrett was as good as Austin Matthews. People would be freaking out for him, you know? It would lead highlight packs. It would lead Sportsnet Central. It would be a huge conversation topic. We would be able to have Knicks guests on.
Jamal Murray blew up.
Right, exactly. All of a sudden you care about the Denver Nuggets, right? Like, you have some interest in them because you want Jamal Murray to do well, and it's just not the same way for them. So I don't think that happens. But yeah, I'm all for the Canadian division. I'm all for less games in this league. And I'm actually sneaky. Have you changed your opinion at all about the play-in games? Because, yeah, I actually think until things go back to normal that I'm not going to be too upset about them, and I actually like them, and I think that they draw interest in for everybody. Like, the more markets involved, again, because it's so regional, the better.
I mean, when we're talking about going back to normal in an 82-game season, I love the idea of having a 7-10, 8-9, best-of-three series.
NBA, it's here to stay.
Yeah. I mean, sorry, is that's happening in the NBA?
Yeah, they have two proposals right now for this season, and both the proposals involve play-in games between the 7 through 10 seeds. Yeah. And I don't see that ever going away. And again, if you're looking for more revenue and you're trying to find ways to make up for what are billions of dollars of losses, I just don't see any scenario where you leave stuff like that off the table, especially considering that it's been successful, it's been fun. And even with this year's Stanley Cup, do you think anyone was really that upset with the way that things played out? Like, you made the case that the Oilers should be the most pissed off before it started, right? I think you wrote that column, or you wrote a piece about that, hey, the Oilers were basically a lock to be in, and they're facing the Chicago team that could beat them, and then lo and behold, of course, it happens. But I still, again, maybe it's because it's too regional, I have my head in the sand, but I don't get the sense that Oilers fans were super pissed off about the format, or that, like, if your team loses that series to the Blackhawks, I know it's hockey, but it's almost like, well, we probably weren't going to win then.
We probably weren't good enough to handle a better team in a longer series. What's so great, too, to me is, like, all right, so up to the 20th best team in the league gets to be physically involved in games, but then how many teams beyond that, how many fan bases beyond that are engaged towards the end of the season? Like, got to be until the 24th best team might think they have a shot all the way until the final weeks, or 25th. You know, if you can keep more fan bases engaged longer, add some extra games for extra revenue, and not to mention the mushy middle in the NHL, like, is the 10th best team better than the 20th? Barely. Like, you know, the line that divides the teams in the middle of the pack is so slim, you might as well give more teams a chance to play some playoff hockey.
Okay, so last one on hockey. I've been pushing this backup goalie thing for a really long time, just the idea that it's going the way of the running back, which is the bell cow. You're only going to have that if you have just an absolute unicorn freak. Mm-hmm. And that, for the most part, it's going to become more and more like a 60-40 split, and it's all going to be about workload. And we've already been trending in this direction, right? Like, again, I've been saying this for years, but now if you're fitting in a 55 to 60 game schedule in a more condensed season, and then you're going to have potentially play-in games and then the rigors of the Stanley Cup Finals, given what we know about goalie effectiveness on back-to-backs, is this not going to be the year where we just see, like, your backup goaltender? And in Toronto, I feel like it's more a point of emphasis now after the last couple of years of what's happened, like from the McElhinney stuff to Michael Hutchinson to all of those things, right? That it's a bigger point of emphasis here than it's been in maybe in other markets. People know it's more important. But is this not the year where we just see basically every team has almost a 60-40 split? Like, how are you going to justify more of that if it's a condensed schedule and if it's 55 games and it's a sprint?
Yeah, I don't really see how you can. And unfortunately, that should hurt a lot of the backup goaltender salaries. But, like, you know, look at Columbus against the Leafs in playoffs. They played both their guys, you know, just said, okay, yep. Well, we like both our guys. We'll see who's fresh tonight and go with that guy. You know, I still think that when you look at how playoffs unfold, you still want to have a guy. So,
yep.
You know, that's obviously the best case scenario to me. You don't see a whole lot of teams toggling players all the way through a cup run. But yeah, in terms of winning games during the regular season, having some sort of battery is going to be the way to go. And personally, I don't love it. I don't love that all these guys, you know, block and they kind of look the same and play the same, and now it feels like you can kind of plug one in or plug this guy out and it's not that much different. But it is the way of the world. It's one of those advances, those statistical changes that have come along because of our, you know, understanding of numbers, and it's definitely here to stay, that's for sure.
No, it's a good point, and it's something that I railed against after the Dodgers won the World Series. Did a big block about how, hey, it's cool that we're finding all these edges and ways to win and looking at percentage points and drop-off and, you know, sports science and all these different things, right? But ultimately, the sports are an entertainment product, and at some point they're going to have to reconcile with the cost-benefit of what is this one extra win worth versus not having goaltenders be cool. Like, I became a goalie as a kid because I loved the style of the position. Like, I was enamored by Dominic Hasek. Like, and I know that's a very unique example, but I loved Hasek to the point where, you know, I was that horrible kid that coaches hated because I tried to replicate his style sometimes, and all it resulted in is people scoring a million goals
just
on me.
Yard sales.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And just, you know, getting super aggressive and skating out and trying to take away breakaways by being, you know, basically at the blue line and getting skated
that's
around
Billy
and
Smith.
Empty cage. Yeah, like, but that's what I wanted to do, right? And I love Felix Potvin. I love the gear. I loved everything about a goaltender. And I just feel like, yeah, now everybody wants to have the exact same guy. They're all the exact same size. Okay, cool. Some guys have some nice gear depending on what your team is, but everyone's basically got the same stuff. There's
it's
only
a
like
legit
a
loss,
companies.
Man. There's no goalie could come in this show and tell me that it's not a loss to the sport, the personality and the flair that used to come with the position. And look, it makes sense to have guys.
Who's the biggest star goalie now? Who's the biggest up and coming star goaltender? Right, like it feels like Henrik Lundqvist is now going. Carey Price is going. Like, once that group leaves, once that group exits, what are we looking at here? Like, yeah. Really?
Carter Hart, Demko, John Gibson.
Okay.
Yeah.
You think Demko's going to play 66 games a year? It's like, no. Like, it's not going to happen.
Luongo, Tim Thomas, even like the more recent guys that worked their way out had, you know, were personalities. So, you know, goalies will remain weird, but certainly the style is going to change because, let's be honest, you'd like a guy who just kind of quietly blocks the puck, you know, for my team. The other team can have the guy who's creative and fun and entertains fans. Every team wants the guy who just stops the puck. So I understand why it happens, but it's a loss for the sport.
It's a huge loss. Again, I don't know how someone would be inspired to play the position right now. Hey, even if you're the best, there's some guy that's almost just like right as good as you. And if there's this one percentage that says that you're going to not perform as well as him tonight and he's fresh and you're not, we're going to go with him and you're going to sit. And, you know, it's like, it's boring. And you guys look the same. You sit across from each other in the dressing room and you're both the exact same size and height. And if you're under, you know, 6'1" at this point, it's like, good luck. They're not even going to take a look at you. So everybody wants a Ben Bishop. Which is fine. It's just, it's just make it again. It saps a lot of the joy out of the sport. It saps a lot of fun out of the sport. And again, for a league like the NHL, I caution it a little bit more than the NFL and the NBA, where I just don't think that you have as much room for error when it comes to taking these things out of the game. Okay, we got to hustle on this. I want two quick golf things. One, okay, what is your – do you have any early Masters theories that you just are kind of rattling around in your brain that you can't stop thinking about?
I just want to watch Bryson DeChambeau because he's talking about using a 48-inch driver. So, like, I think right now he uses a 46 or 45. Like, 48 is the maximum legal allowable. It's what the long drive contest guys use. He's already hitting it 400 yards. It's a course that rewards guys who hit the ball a long way. He's just going to try to hit the golf ball 500 yards. It's going to be unbelievable.
He is unquestionably the most interesting golfer at the Masters, and Tiger Woods is going to be there, which is
first time ever since Tiger's been around.
Exactly. With Tiger Woods at Augusta, and there's another golfer that you're more interested in and saying, no, actually, this is going to be the story, and this is the thing that's going into the weekend. I'm going to save my theory for you for next week. I have a thought on – I'm going to save it because we're low on time, and I need to get this in. Okay, so our buddy Sam McKee, right?
Yeah.
Our guy. I'm having a wisdom tooth taken out tomorrow, actually. This is the last day with me and old Toothy. I have to get a wisdom tooth out. They're giving me the – what's the one where – general anesthesia, right? They're putting me out. They're giving me the IV.
Wow.
They're just like – yeah, they're knocking me out. Actually, the lady scared the crap out of me, I got to say. She's like, there's a 2% chance that you could just have a numb mouth for the rest of your life. I was like, well, I'm a radio broadcaster. And she's like, well, it shouldn't affect your ability to speak. And I was like, I feel like it would. I feel like that would fundamentally change who I am as a person. But either way, like, yeah. And then she does the thing because she's trying not to get herself sued by me, even though all I want to know is I'm saying, hey, is it worth it? And she's like, I don't want you to feel pressured either way. I'm like, you're the oral surgeon. Just please tell me if I need to do this or not. For God's sakes, I trust you. Can I sign a thing where I won't sue you based on your advice? I'm like, what if I was your kid? Trying to get her to do that stuff, right? She's not weighing in, not helping me at all. But she's kind of giving me the body language of you got to get it out. So I'm getting out this tooth. I'm not really that worried about it. But I asked Sam, who lives not far from where I'm getting it taken out. He lives in the same neighborhood as me, one of my best friends on the planet Earth. Hey, after I get the consultation, this is going to be the day that this happens. Can you pick me up after? He's like, no problem, buddy. I got you.
Yeah.
He texted me yesterday that, hey, can I send my fiance? She's this tiny girl. I don't know how drugged up I'm going to be. He's like, hey, can I send my fiance? I booked a tea time.
Oh.
It's going to be nice outside. And I got offered a spot in a foursome. Is he the worst friend on the planet, or am I the dick for saying, oh, excuse me, what? You're bailing on me in my moment of need after surgery that's putting me out unconscious, and you're going to send your tiny fiance to pick me up? That's your strategy? Who's the jerk? Because you're the golfer, and maybe I set this up unfairly. Like, he did offer a solution, and maybe I'm fine, and maybe his fiance can help me just as well as he can. Who knows? But, you know, I got stairs going up to my apartment, and who knows how, like, shaky I'm going to be. I just feel like this is a brutal, brutal move by this guy.
Here's what I know. If I had committed to pick you up, after you got a wisdom tooth out on some drugs, and someone offered me a tea time in the middle of, like, November, maybe the last time I can get out all year, it's going to be a nice day, I would be like, I cannot fathom a situation where I'm going to say no to this tea time because JD needs it to be me who picks him up. I think I'm bailing.
I knew it.
I think I'm bailing.
I knew you would say that. That's why I needed to ask you is because I just wanted the truth. it's also nice all week, right? Like, this is not a situation where it's the last time you're going to get to golf.
Yeah.
It's nice today. It's nice on Thursday. It's nice on Friday. It's nice on Saturday. It's nice on Sunday. It's nice on Monday. It's nice on Tuesday. This last whole week is good. And this is why I hate you golfers, is that you always act like there's this sense of urgency to this thing, even though this has been the year where everyone has played more golf than ever because it's the only thing to do. And anyone with a partner has been able to tell their wife, like, we've been cooped up in the pandemic and now I need this for the stress relief and it's got to be golf or nothing. And so you've all played a million rounds. It's extending into November as is. You get an extra bonus week and now all of a sudden Thursday is the only day that anyone can golf ever and it's the winter is coming and boo-hoo, boo-hoo.
I think I would have forgot to tell you that I wasn't picking you up till day of, then just text you like, I got to be out, man. I'll cover the Uber.
I forgot that I was asking the scummiest bail guy of all time who's bailed on me in like
the worst part is that
conditions.
Like I was a scummy bail guy before I had kids, and now that I have kids, it's like unlimited passes for bailing. What a world.
People with kids in the pandemic have become just it's their superpower, the ability to bail and not do anything with just, hey, sorry, the kids and the pandemic and COVID. It's just you're like, oh, okay, even though then you see those people doing stuff.
Yeah, say something. Say something back to that. Say something.
Exactly.
You
just have to eat it. You just have to eat it. We got to run. This was fun, buddy. Thanks again for doing everything today. And, enjoy the stresses of next week. And congratulations on being an Arizona voter, by the way. Hey,
yes,
way to go.
Thank you.
Good for you.
Thank you
very much,
Arizona.
All right, buddy. Go Wildcats.
All right, have a good show.
Thanks, pal. When we come back, it's John Morosi, Trevor Bauer, the Tees. That's next on Good Show on Sports 95.9 of the Fan. Yeah, no, we're closer in age than you'd think, man. Like, I graduated high school in 2005, so, like, that's...
There you go.
Like, we're right there. But I missed that by a little bit. That would have been, again, you guys would have been older and cooler, and you would have had your own music, and if I would have tried to borrow that CD from a friend's older brother, he would have beat the tar out of me for touching it. So, like, that's how that works back then. It's like you'd sneak into your friend's older brother's room and be like, dude, let's get that Tool CD, and let's get that cranking, and then he'd find out that you touched his Tool CD, and then, beatings all around. So that's basically...
I mean, CDs, and then, of course, the original
Tower.
Online music source would have been Napster and all these different things that existed. And I would say this, I would talk and chat with my then girlfriend, now wife, on AOL Instant Messenger, which is now no longer around. So I've often said I feel old when the method of new communication over which you chatted with your then girlfriend, now wife, is officially extinct, and that has already happened to me.
Yeah, MSN Messenger and putting up
very
emo, very emotional things if you were trying to get the attention of a girl. That was a tough time. You know, I said I would rather have my search history revealed than my MSN Messenger profile, whatever those things were that went beside it, your little write up that went beside your name. Much rather have the search history revealed, like no question about it. So. Again, man, thanks for doing this today. I know everybody's tired. I know everybody's exhausted. But let's start with this. Trevor Bauer, right? He's just going around and he's basically tweeting that everyone is a destination. He adds the Toronto thing. We're total suckers for it. We put it everywhere. I'm doing it right now. He tweeted something like Toronto is a nice city, could be a destination after I think it was a segment on MLB Network. There was a host that mentioned him potentially going there. But do you actually view Toronto as a legitimate destination for Trevor Bauer? Because, it feels like if you're going to get him, it's going to be, you're going to have to come with, he's not going to settle for anything short of the biggest dollar amount.
Right. And first of all, we're about to have one of the more unique free agencies in the league's history, because I had this thought, and certainly I'm aware that in most years that when I would report something or say something about a player, obviously there's a good chance that it's eventually going to get back to him during the course of free agency. That's sort of how things go. But now it's really going to get back to him immediately because he he's always on Twitter, which is great, by the way. It's great that he's part of the conversation. And I'm thinking to myself, if I say, well, this team has checked in with him or is interested in him, like within seconds it'll probably say, yeah, they are, or no, they're not. It's going to be met with immediate applause or scorn, which, again, is perfectly healthy and great. I'm all about the sort of free exchange of ideas on social media, especially by the people who are involved in the story, which is great. I think we're going to have this scenario play out in real time where normally free agents are coached to not say things or to keep their opinions private. That's not at all the case with Trevor. He's an open book, which is great. And so I think that do I believe Toronto is a favorite to sign him? I think it's way too early to make that determination. Clearly, he is known well by Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins just because of the, of course, going back to Cleveland, just the overall communication there. There's a good amount of understanding of what Trevor's all about, who he is as a pitcher. There's not a lot of surprises there. And I think now it's just going to be a question of, to your point, who comes up with the best offer. Trevor, for a long time, has said he wants to keep playing on one-year deals. Is that still going to be the case now? This is obviously a different economic environment due to the pandemic. How does that affect things? There are so many variables. I think that the biggest variable of all, though, is going to be money. And if the Jays make an offer that is substantially higher for Trevor than other clubs, then there's a decent chance he's a Blue Jay. But that was the reason why Hyunjin Ryu signed with Toronto. It all came down to the economics, and I think Toronto has to decide now, the club, how aggressive they're going to be relative to the other teams in the league in terms of bidding for the top free agents. And I do think, and I have heard from executives around the game, they do expect Toronto to be very aggressive. But that also could involve re-signing someone like a Taiwan Walker, who I think was pretty darn good for Toronto down the stretch.
John, I got to tell you, if being very aggressive is re-signing Taiwan Walker, I'm going to be pissed off. I'm going to be pissed.
I appreciate that perspective, but I would say this on the overall availability of free agents. Taiwan Walker, in terms of ERA plus, is the second best free agent pitcher out there after Trevor Bauer by that measure, by ERA plus. So, yep. So if somebody may want to say, well, okay, you put Charlie Morton ahead of him. I don't think Charlie Morton, of course, we've heard so much about how he wants to be close to home. I would doubt that Charlie Morton's even an option for the Blue Jays. So you move a little further down the list. Stroman, would you bring him back? That's a question. Tanaka, maybe. But I don't look at those pitchers as being necessarily better than Walker. So if you're not going to sign Bauer, I'm here to tell you that by the numbers – I'm not so sure that there's a better option out there right now than Taiwan Walker if you're not going to be able to sign Bauer.
Yeah, no, and I agree with that. I think that what I'm more trying to get at is that cannot be your centerpiece of your offseason, in my opinion, is that it's got to be something a little bit splashier. It's got to be based a little bit bigger based on, the idea that everyone does realize that, hey, there is a chance to flex financial muscle. Hey, that Toronto is in a unique position. Hey, that the Red Sox are down. Hey, that the Tampa Bay Rays look like they're going to try and shed salary, that they are not going to be one of those aggressive teams. Hey, look at where you are. This group does not like to trade prospects. They don't have a lot of money on the books. Their second biggest contract is a guy that, frankly, I don't think that they would want on the team in Randall Grichuk if they had their druthers now. But he only makes what, $10 million? Like, it's not. There's a big chance for a big swing here. I want one more Trevor Bauer question, then I want to get back into this. But you mentioned the thing about the history with Cleveland, and this was my one point of curiosity when it comes to Bauer in particular. Is how do you think that actually plays for him here in terms of the interest? Because when he was in Cleveland, he did that Sports Illustrated article where he basically sewered the organization and said, hey, if Corey Kluber listened to me, he'd be a better pitcher. And the only guy who does is Shane Bieber. And Mike Clevinger, and looking at how good he is now. And he basically just ranted and raved about how he knows better than most places and most organizations. And when you say the Stroman thing, I'm like, yeah, they got rid of Stroman essentially because they did not like his presence in the clubhouse, the locker room. They didn't like having that there. Do you think that it would hurt Trevor Bauer at all, like his history with Cleveland, that organization? Are those guys sour on him one bit, or is that a non-concern to you?
It certainly is part of it. It's part of the overall question. I mean, Trevor Bauer obviously is very opinionated. He has his own program. He has a specific set of ideas that he's going to want to pursue on and off the field. The his involvement in social media, which, again, I take the 30,000-foot view here, and if we as a sport look at it and say, yeah, we want our players to engage more with fans and become having a higher profile on social media, and then you can't then say that and then say, well, wait a minute, I don't want you to be that candid. No, this is part of it. And I think it's part of relating to the young athlete, the young fan, and engaging with Gen Z, however you want to describe it. And so there are no secrets there about what Bauer would bring because Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins already know that. Now, do they look at that favorably? I think to your point, given the way things played out with Stroman, given some of the comments Trevor made about the Indians front office, I could see that potentially affecting their enthusiasm for him. I could. But the reality also is this guy is a likely Cy Young winner, and if you want to win and if you want to have the best club you can, you have to make a pretty strong case that he is on that club. I mean, he is to me the marquee free agent pitcher out there. And you know JD as well as I do, or as anybody else does. You look around the history of sports, and the ability for you to be candid, outspoken, authentic, and say things that might excite or agitate others, the ability for you to do that is directly proportional to your ability to perform. And Trevor Bauer performs. He does. And his level of preparation and care and precision is one of the best in the sport, if not the best among all pitchers in terms of his ability to prepare and how much he cares about it. So I think that if you look at it and say, do I want to win and do I want to make that impact? I think if it means saving your job, if it means winning a championship, I think he's someone that you have to look at very seriously. And there are certainly no surprises when it comes to the Blue Jays. So you take the good with the bad. And I think for Trevor Bauer this past year, there's been a lot more good than bad, especially when you consider his performance on the field.
No, I'm totally with you, dude. I think that Trevor Bauer is actually one of, if not the best figure for the sport right now. Like, baseball has been so desperate for relevancy, especially on social media and online. And, yeah, I just think that Trevor Bauer, okay, so if you don't agree with everything he says, and this is, man, maybe we're going too deep on this, but, okay, like, that's fine. You can disagree with him. It doesn't mean that you need to vilify him into saying that he's the worst person on the internet, because I think that the bullying stuff is grossly exaggerated by people. I'm sorry, but I've seen his track record with it, and it's like he's quote tweeting people who don't like him. And like, if you don't like that heat, then don't do that to people. And yet there's a faction of, I don't know, baseball people on Twitter that are like, oh, this is bullying. This is bullying. It's like, okay, just relax. And ultimately, yeah, the guy is good for the sport because he makes people engage in discussion about him, that he is polarizing and that he does pitch that well and that he does put this much effort into his craft and that he is willing to start up a YouTube channel and break down a time where someone takes him yard a bunch of times and actually gives you really nice insight into the game and makes you feel like you're a smarter baseball fan. So no, I'm all in on Trevor Bauer. I do have questions about, as you get further and further into the analytics side of things, having a guy who would vociferously disagree with your decision making as a club, like if you are someone like the Blue Jays and wants to take him out after the fifth inning and 74 pitches like they did with Blake Snell in Tampa, how that's going to play out and whether or not you're going to be comfortable with that, like, because I do see that.
And that's a fair point. And I would say the Reds let him be Trevor. The Reds let him be himself, right, by and large, in terms of letting him get his innings and also letting him express himself and where his sincerity was. And I know that was something David Bell talked about a lot as his manager, that, you know, knowing what's in the players' hearts and where their attitude is and how they feel about things. He is someone who is truly authentic. And obviously, to your point, does it concern a club that you know, in keeping with MLB guidelines as it relates to social media, if you take him out in the fifth inning, is he going to be sitting at his locker waiting for the final out so that he can then send out a tweet about the decision? I don't know. And you have to sort of understand that that's part of the equation here in 2021 as we look towards next year. You have to be prepared for that. And again, I think, as to your point, JD, as a sport, if we're about trying to engage and make the stars more relatable and learn more about them, it's you cannot then edit what they're saying. That's the issue here. It's if we want them to be more accessible and more relatable to the young generation, that's for better or worse how the young generation communicates. And I think that we have to let the players be the players. And I think Bauer, he's someone that I really have enjoyed interviewing, because certainly he can be curt at times. We've seen that. Yep. But also, he'll tell you what's on his mind. I love the question late in the season. Do you see yourself as the frontrunner to win the Cy Young Award? And he said, I don't see how you could see it any other way. That's beautiful. That's a great quote. And I love the candor that he has. And I think on measure, it's a very good thing for the game.
Yeah, I totally agree. Again, this is a sport where we have to constantly do the whole every MLB All-Star weekend is the, and we got some reprieve from it this year because of no MLB All-Star weekend, but the whole who's the face of the game thing. And it feels like Mookie Betts has become a real star. It feels like Trevor Bauer is a real star. He's a household name, and I'm not sure if we've really been having that over the last few years with baseball, and it is a positive sign. So again, if we're both working under the premise that the Blue Jays are expected to be aggressive, right, and that they could even entertain the possibility of a Trevor Bauer, I would say that, and you can disagree with me, like, totally, if I would say that this free agent class is about, for the Blue Jays fans anyways, four guys, that it comes down to, can you get Realmuto, can you get Bauer, can you get Springer, or can you get LeMahieu? And if you end up with one of those four guys, it's a coup for this organization, and anything else below could be exciting. I'm not saying that it wouldn't be cool to get like a Justin Turner or even a like you said, a Tanaka, but that ultimately it comes down to those four guys. As when we're talking aggressive, I think most people are circling those four names. Is it in your opinion that that is going to be realistic, that the Blue Jays actually do have a shot? And if there is one of those four guys that you think they would be targeting, it would be who?
Well, it's a great question about the – and I love bringing up Realmuto, because I think he is someone that is going to draw huge interest. I think that he will get a lot of interest in the NL East, specifically Phillies and Mets.
Yeah.
And if he goes to one of those two places, I would say from the Jays' perspective, James McCann feels like – as much of a logical play for the Jays as Realmuto would be. I think he's going to be cheaper. He is someone who I think would address the Jays behind the plate from a standpoint of just the comprehensiveness, an offensive, defensive player, very experienced, still a young veteran, I would say, from a standpoint of where he's at overall with his career trajectory. So I think that Realmuto may be a little bit either out of the Jays' price range, or maybe he just wants to stay and play in the division where he's been playing his entire career, because there's going to be so much interest for him in that division where he's already comfortable. LeMahieu, I think, is a great idea, and I think that where he would play, to me, maybe he bounces around a little bit, maybe he plays, you know, close to a full-time second base, and then Biggio moves around a little bit from there. But I think LeMahieu is a very intriguing player. I also think LaStella makes a lot of sense. Tommy LaStella was a guy that I thought, you know, trade deadline time would have made a lot of sense as well. Lefty bat, can move around the diamond a little bit. I think trying to see what Vlad's future is, I think, is obviously part of this. Is he definitely going to be a first baseman? Is there still a thought that he can play some third? What kind of shape does he show up to? I think that's where guys like LeMahieu and LaStella in general, who can move around the diamond a little bit, are really appealing, because I think as much as we may say that there was enough concern that we saw with Vlad's defense, that maybe you say, yeah, okay, he's going to be a first base or maybe even a, you know, first base DH, I think it's awfully hard for me to sign someone like Turner, for example, who I think is a true third baseman full stop, when I think that signing the more versatile player just to let things play out a bit more with Vlad. He's still a young player. I get there's worries about how he has played to this point, but goodness, I would hate to really lock him into a particular position that's not third base quite yet. I think you need to see a little bit more before you make that decision and really kind of locking yourself into a multi-year free agent deal that's predicated on knowing definitively where Vlad's going to play.
Yeah, I think that's smart. And again, I've said this before about Bo Bichette, because there's been questions about him moving off a shortstop. I said, I want the guy who comes on the show like Bo did and says, it would be a major disappointment for me if I had to move off shortstop, that it would need to be a significant upgrade, because I want guys who believe in themselves and who want to keep getting better and who have those goals. And Someone tweeted at me yesterday that Vlad Jr. said on a live stream that he wants to go back to third base next season. And while that is still a bit of a, I would say, I don't want to say terrifying prospect because he really wasn't good there. But yeah, I don't want to put a limit on him. I want him to believe that he can get in great shape and that he can improve at third base and that he can hold down that position. Because if he does that, it changes the entire complexion of this roster. And they certainly don't need just, you know, another DH. I'm totally with you. John, this was great.
You're right. And the one thought, just to piggyback on that, JD, is this, that, and sorry to cut you off, but the essential character of this team is that group of young position players, homegrown. Yep. That's your club. The free agents are nice, and these guys could be additive. You can add a LeMahieu or a LaStella or a McCann, and they can help. But this team is going to go as far as Bichette and Guerrero and Biggio and Gurriel take them. That's the team. Those are the guys. And we can talk about additive guys, and we should. And maybe there's one more pitcher to add. But look at the teams that have won. Look at the Dodgers. Look at, in recent years, the Cubs. Look at the Astros. Look at the team. The Red Sox, another great example. Homegrown position players, by and large, are the essence of the team. Even the Dodgers, with all their assets, yes, they got Mookie Betts, but who is the MVP of the NLCS? Who is the MVP of the World Series? Corey Seager, homegrown guy. Cody Bellinger, homegrown guy. Okay, Kike Hernandez, a glue guy for them. They got him when he was young in a trade and sort of brought him up in the organization. That's your team. Those are your guys for the Blue Jays. And I think, to your point, when you've got a franchise guy like Bichette, and if he wants to play in the middle of the diamond, he's still a young player, let him play there. That's his identity. And I think you can't get too jumpy and say, well, this guy can't play here, play there. When it's one of your core guys, and for better or worse, these are your core guys, you got to let them have enough time and space to tell you who they are. They'll tell you in time. Let them be. And I think that if Vlad in his mind is doing a great job in the Dominican, getting himself into shape, let him play. And to your point, I think it's a great point, JD, have that as his goal. Don't have him show up and all of a sudden Turner's there to play third base and who am I? What am I doing here? You don't want him to begin that season with that mentality. Let him play the position that he believes he can play and aspire to. And the same thing with Bo. The field for the Blue Jays looks better, in my opinion, when Bo Bichette is in the middle of it. And I think those guys on the field know how great of a player he is and how great he can be. Let him be in the middle of the diamond. He belongs, in my opinion, in the middle of that diamond.
Well, that's really well said, man. And I can't wait to keep talking to you throughout this offseason because, again, it's such a fascinating one for Blue Jays fans. I can't wait. I hope it's not as slow-moving as people think, but I really appreciate the time today, John. This was awesome, dude.
You bet, JD. It gives us more time to talk. You know, the slower moving it is, we have more time to talk about it. We'll have hockey back eventually. We'll have Champions League day to day. Lots of good stuff going on.
Thanks, buddy. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, JD. I appreciate it. All the best.
See you, man. Yeah, I guess there's more time for me to BS and for me to build my hopes up about the idea of the Jays landing one of those big four guys. And getting to talk to John, it is always great to try to read between the lines of some of the insiders sometimes. Like, you know, he's bringing up names like James McCann. And that's kind of interesting that they would be looking at a catcher that isn't a star, a superstar anyways. And so who is 30 years old when we saw what we saw from Kirk and that you don't really want to give up on Danny Jansen yet. And there's one other guy in the organization, or maybe it is Kirk, but either way, that's a position they would be looking at. But I still feel, not to take it down a notch, I really want one of those big four. It feels like Real Muto is off the table because, again, now John is the second insider to say on this show in back-to-back days that it's Mets or Phillies. But out of the other three guys, if they don't land one of those big fish, that you're going to see the Jays add just a surplus of good players and that they are going to get way better around the fringes and have a way deeper roster, which I'm good with too. Again, spend money, make your team better, supplement those young guys. It's very similar to the Leafs situation of, hey, all the other stuff, Joe Thornton, that's cool. Wayne Simmons, that's cool. TJ Brody, that's cool. But what matters is your young core. And that's the same with the Blue Jays. When we come back, Blue Jays superfan, who I can't wait to actually talk to about the Blue Jays. I want to see how he feels about this too. And host of Ariel Helwani's MMA show, DC and Helwani, Ariel and the Bad Guy. It's Ariel Helwani. That's next on Good Show on Sportsnet 5-9 of the Fan. It's Good Show on Sportsnet 5-9 of the Fan. I'm J.D. Bunkus. No Benny this week. It's always good when I get to spread out the wings a little bit with our next guest. He's one of my favorites. Hosts a couple of the best shows on the planet. Ariel Helwani's MMA show. DC and Helwani. Ariel and the Bad Guy. It's ESPN's Ariel Helwani. What's up, bro?
Hey, guys. How are you? Good to be back on.
Good, man.
And thank you for
yeah,
that.
Man. Of course, of course.
Do you want to apologize to Josh Donaldson yet, or should we do that later?
Never. No, dude, okay. Listen, I'll always listen, hold a bro. Special place in my heart for Josh Donaldson, right? He's the bringer of rain.
And that's it. That's it. It ends right there.
Thanksgiving Sunday night.
When he slid, like Kelly Gruber, like you cannot say anything bad about it. So what? No, it ends,
so
period. It was
and
so
the
great.
Series against
you should
the
apologize
Angels,
to him right now. Yes.
He won MVP. And he just ripped it from the clutches of Mike Trout. Everyone who had the, well, Trout plays the more premium position. And then the Blue Jays went and beat the wheels off of them. And Donaldson basically just had home run or double in every single AB. That's how my brain remembers it. But I'm sorry, the guy has horrible MMA takes. And, like, I don't have to agree with everything Josh Donaldson does. My understanding of Josh Donaldson is that he puts his cookies into his milk and lets them dissipate and then drinks the cookie milk. Like, he's the AL MVP
in
2015? Someone told me that. A friend of his told me that that's what he does. It's a Florida guy move, and he's a Florida guy. And I don't agree with a lot of things Florida guys think, okay? And so this happens to be one. His idea that Khabib is a boring fighter, I don't know how anyone could stand on that island. I don't know how a single solitary person could say, like, I love GSP more than anything. I'm waiting today, actually, for a delivery from Roots of Fight to bring me my new GSP gear. My favorite athlete of all time. And when people said he was boring, not for me, because I wanted him to get the W, I wanted him to get the check mark, but there were a few fights that I think we can all acknowledge where GSP kind of just laid on top of dudes and it wasn't the most thrilling venture, knowing that he wasn't going to get a finish. There's nothing not exciting about Khabib just choking the life out of the three top lightweights in the division and just saying, yeah, like, that's it, say two. There's nothing not exciting about that guy standing and striking with Gaethje for a round and letting him and giving him an actual opportunity to win. So I'm sorry, Josh Donaldson. You are the MVP. You are the bringer of rain, but you are also the bringer of horrible, horrible MMA takes, and I will stand on that island till the day I die.
Okay, fair enough. And for the audience, they may not know what we're talking about. I host this debate, if you will, between here I am playing host on your own show, between Donaldson and Carlos Correa, the 2015 AL Rookie of the Year versus the 2015 AL MVP, both massive MMA fans. And dare I say, I did more for Carlos Correa's PR. I did more for his public persona than anyone has done for him over the past year. I mean, this guy was having people actually rooting for him and supporting him in the comment section of this video. And, of course, we know how people feel about Carlos Correa. So Carlos Correa deserves something from Carlos Correa, like, I don't know, a basket or, you know, fruit plate or something. In any event, it was fun. I like talking to athletes about MMA. It's fun. I agree with everything you said, of course. Khabib is not boring. Of course, he's not the most boring fighter of all time, and you can make a case he's a power. It was just fun, and I was just surprised that a Toronto guy would talk about, you know, the man who gave us so much great memories 5 years ago, the way in which you did. That's all.
I hate that was 5 years ago. Whenever people say stuff like that, I'm like, how is that possible? I feel like I was still just there. I feel like I was still just celebrating that night with friends and high five. What a different time. I literally, the night of the bat flip, I, with three of my closest friends, just walked up and down Front Street high-fiving people all night. Like, that was the number. My hand hurt the next day from high fives, and it's hard to believe that, you know, we'll ever see a reality again where you just high-five tens of thousands of strangers over a given night. I hope we do get back. And okay, let me ask you this, because you like talking about
MMA. The way,
with,
I hope that,
yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I just want to say I hope you also have. I'm sorry I didn't listen earlier, but I hope you've apologized to Charlie Montoyo, manager of the year finalist, Vlad, the rest of the boys. You've probably done that already, right?
No, I won't. God, okay. I want to talk Blue Jays with you. That's what the setup is going to be. Is that, hey, yeah, I know you do. And that's the thing. I wanted to talk Blue Jays with you. I wanted to talk about the offseason, and I will do my Charlie Montoyo thing with you right now. I have nothing against Charlie Montoyo. In fact, he seems like a real sweetheart of a guy. I watched Steven Brunt's feature on him, and he seems unbelievably likable. He seems incredibly competitive. In fact, it was strange to see a younger version of Charlie Montoyo freaking out and in dugouts and losing his cool because he just seems like such a calm, collected, and I don't know, kind individual. And I think he's – I remember him getting his first major league win and him getting in the showers and them showering him with his gear on. Like, a likable guy. He seems fun. I probably don't give him enough credit because I don't see the things that he can actually do for that clubhouse. But here's the thing, man. I watched every single Blue Jays game this year. And saying that he's the manager of the year based on the Blue Jays decision-making either in the field or on the base paths is – first of all, a complete non-starter for him. But then the in-game decision-making, the way that he rolled out lineups and the way that he employed his bullpen and his pitching staff, he cost his team more wins than he got them as a manager. And that's always my bar for a good manager or coach is like, hey, don't interfere with your team's success because the positions mean less and less and less. And I'm sorry, if it was the charts, it was the charts where that guided him. I don't care. Charlie Montoyo hurt his team more from a strategy standpoint this year than he did good. And so I can't understand the logic behind how you give someone that award. I actually think it's just a lazy narrative award to say, well, this team, everyone expected them to be bad, and they were a little bit better than we expected them to be, even though a lot of people projected the Blue Jays to be that last playoff team. And so he automatically gets this award, and we're giving it to coaching? Like, huh? Just give me the evidence that he's supposed to be the manager of the year. That's all I'm asking from people who want to make that case is give me the evidence. Give me the cold facts.
Well, I'll say this. I don't think he ultimately gets it, number one. Number two, I do think that you are overlooking a little bit what he did in the clubhouse. Like, you can nitpick base running issues and all the, and decisions to keep a guy in or not bring in another guy off the bench and all that stuff. That's fine, and I know what you're referring to. But come on, we do have to give the guy a little bit of credit for keeping this team together when, A, they were decimated with injuries, decimated, and, B, they couldn't stay at home. They couldn't be with their families. I know a lot of them are young and probably don't have, you know, a wife or three kids and all that stuff. But still, like, they're on the road. For the first 2 weeks, they're on the road. They have to play in a AAA ballpark. Like, these are a lot of things. This whole thing could have been a total disaster. And, by the way, who are these pundits that were saying that the Blue Jays were going to make the playoffs and be the 8th seed? I didn't see those people.
Ben Ennis said from day one it would be a disappointment if they didn't make the playoffs with expansion.
Anyone could pick one random guy. But the and with all due respect to Ben, great at his job. I'm just saying the vast majority did not think too highly of their chances this year. And I just think that the way he kept it together, kept the morale up, look, they got lucky here and there. Sure, they had some, you know, late inning heroics. All that's fine. But I do think he deserves some credit. Do I think ultimately that he's the manager of the year? Actually, no, I don't. I think Cash probably is, despite the blunder in the World Series. But I just think that you're a little too hard on the guy. I mean, look where they were 2 years ago. And I know that a lot of these players have come up and they're a lot better than they were 2 years ago, but I don't think anyone thought that we'd be talking about the Blue Jays in this kind of terms, these glowing terms, this soon into his tenure as manager. So I think you need to lay off Charlie, a former Expo, I might add.
Yeah, I'm very receptive to the idea that I am too hard on Charlie. Very receptive to it.
Okay.
Very, very, very. All right. However, all I want to say is that when we do the here's what we assume he does with the clubhouse thing or behind closed doors, I think that it's just as hard for me to say. I could play the other side of it where I'm like, well, you know, maybe they were listening more to Dante Bichette. Or maybe they listen more to Pete Walker. Like, again, we don't know those things. So it's looking at the body of evidence
for a reason to hate on the guy.
No, I'm not hating. I'm just saying I'm looking at the things that we can actually quantify or that I can quantify. And from my perspective, if someone who's embedded in that clubhouse or really understands or knows the players and they reach out to him, right? Like, let's say, actually, man, more likely you than me, because players might actually want to come on your show and talk with you. But it's more likely
that they want to come on your show?
No, they come on all the time, and some guys are great, and some guys, you know, don't really want to do it. It's how it is with everybody's show. But, you know, it's always tough publicly to get a truthful stance on how guys feel about their bosses, of course, right?
Sure.
It's in private. And so I haven't heard anything from a player privately about not liking Charlie Montoyo or not believing in Charlie Montoyo, which is, again, it's a valuable thing for him. I'm just saying that I do believe that when we have to start over-quantifying the unquantifiable, that's when we start to get into, like, what I think can be sometimes a little bit lazy narratives, where it's like, yeah, what Charlie was the reason that they stuck together? I'm like, maybe it was Caleb Joseph. It seems like Caleb Joseph, from all indications, had more to do with it than Charlie Montoyo in terms of that group being friendly with one another. Hey,
Listen, quickly before we
you want cold hard facts? 32 and 28, a game back to the Yankees. There's your cold hard
facts.
Yeah, right?
And that matters. That's, you know what? That's the best fact. And listen, I'll just give it to you. He deserves to be there. He deserves to be in the top three. What do you want the Jays to do this offseason? Like, what do you care about the most? If you could pick one free agent, you could pick one thing. Errol Hawani, you get a genie who only grants Blue Jays wishes, and you get one wish. What is it?
Oh, man. Honestly, it actually isn't what you're referring to. I want Vladimir Guerrero to get in shape.
Yeah.
That's really, like, my one wish. Like, if you ask me for one wish, truly, I want the young man to get in shape. And I don't want to say to start taking his career seriously, but, you know, clearly that's an issue. Clearly this season didn't really go as most people thought it would. I'm not ready, unlike you, to call him a bust or to trade him, send him off to some, you know, Siberia team, like send him off to Oakland where they'll fleece us, and then he'll become MVP, much like Josh Donaldson was a few years back. I just want him to get in shape. That's my one wish, truly, because I love this team. And yeah, I know there's, you know, rumblings and Bauer and all this stuff, but like, I really do like this young core. And obviously they were hit by injuries, but I have high hopes for the young man, and I just want him to be in shape.
Yeah. You know what, man? I actually think that's correct. Apparently he was talking about playing third base on Instagram Live the other night, and that's still a goal for him. He looks like he's in a bit better shape. I said actually on yesterday's show that he's got the most fascinating Instagram account out of any Toronto athlete, because it's a window into what he's doing and whether he's working out and what he looks like. And it's the only one where you can actually debate and discuss. Like, I don't care what's going on with Mitch Marner's Instagram account. I'm sorry. I just want to see what Vlad Jr. looks like on a day-to-day basis. Yes. I've never wanted, you know, they say you never should post food pictures, like food pics, because it's like, who cares about your food pics? I want Vlad Jr.'s food pics. Like, I want to see what that dude is eating, and I want to see his gym selfies. I want it all. Like, he's the guy. He's the exception to all of those Instagram rules that I normally hate.
By the way, and how about this? Yeah. Your colleague Ben Nicholson-Smith just tweeted literally seconds ago that Vlad Jr. revealed that he's already down 12 pounds this offseason. Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah, see?
On a Reddit. Man, something on a Reddit. Benny. I don't know. Maybe they were recapping his IG. I'm a big fan of Ben. He does a great job, and I love the podcast that he does with Arden. I'm a fan. I listen to all the stuff. I know you don't have me on here to talk about baseball. I'm shocked that we're talking about it this
long.
What
do you mean? I'm having you on today to talk about baseball. This is what we're doing.
Oh, this is it? Danielle told me we were going to talk about.
What? Yeah, listen, I got a couple of MMA things I want to get to. But, yeah, of course I wanted to pick your brain about some Blue Jay stuff. You're coming on and shoot it about what's going to happen. And I will just say this, that Ben Nicholson-Smith is not only one of the more plugged-in dudes around the building and just a great writer, great podcast host, but also just Hall of Fame good guy. Like, if you get to hang out with someone, if we had approval ratings at Sportsnet for people who are the most liked, he would be easily among the top of the top. Like, just a genuine sweetheart of a dude. Okay, so I'm gonna pick your brain on a couple of MMA things now. Let me start with this, actually. This is a bit of a deeper cut, but I need to do it because I'm a huge fan, and I don't care. I love Tough. I'm a huge Ultimate Fighter fan. I think I've watched every season that is not an international version, and they're bringing it back. And the problem was, at the end, they couldn't really find talent, and the way that guys had pathways to the UFC became very different, and Usman was the last kind of star they found, and that was 2015, and I think the show ended in 2018. We've had a couple of years away. This is all I want to know is, are they going to put an emphasis on high-end fighters in this season, like people with real upside to become stars? Is this the reason that it was pushed back to a certain degree? Like, what does the future of that television show look like? Because it's a lot tougher when you start to do the seasons like the Redemption one, where you know that you're not going to find anybody who is going to have the upside of a champion.
Well, here's my issue with Tough, and I'm happy to finally speak to the one person who says that they've watched all 28 seasons leading up to
this
point.
My old roommate Matt Hayes watched everyone, too. We were the only
ones.
Wow,
okay, there's two people.
Yeah, two of
us. Well done. The problem with Tough was, in the early days, in 2005, the UFC was putting on 8-9 shows a year. There weren't as many regional promotions. It was a lot easier to find serious, great fighters, legit fighters who are ready to take that next step, who are going to be big players in the UFC. And then as time went on, and the UFC is now doing 42 or so shows a year, and now it's like almost every weekend, the talent pool is not as deep as it once was. there's Bellator out there who is signing fighters who are 0-0 blue chip prospects who aren't going out and fighting regional promotions. You don't get an opportunity to bring them into Tough. And oh, by the way, the biggest difference between now and then is we also have the Contender Series. And the Contender Series is an outlet for the UFC to get these guys into their quote unquote farm system. And if they like them, if they win, they give them a contract. If not, maybe they give them a developmental deal and they go fight elsewhere. If not, they say, hey, go out, get a couple wins, and come back. And so now, like, where are the fighters coming from? Where are these fighters that they're going to have on Tough? So I don't have the highest of hopes. Like, Contender Series returns tonight. They just finished, I think, 10 straight weeks a few weeks ago. Now it's returning for a second run in this quarter. And I just don't know where they're going to get these great fighters from, because there's, like, an arms race right now between the UFC and Bellator to sign. Like, being a UFC-caliber fighter doesn't mean what it once meant. What it once meant was, you know, you had at least 10 fights on your record, and, you know, you were ready to take that step all the time. Now the UFC is signing guys who are 1-0 or 0-0, things of that nature. So it doesn't mean the same, and I'm just worried for Tough's sake that they're not going to find the same caliber of fighter that, you know, you, a hardcore fan of Tough, have come to expect from the show. So the jury for me is a little out. The reason why they're doing it ultimately is that, honestly, UFC content on ESPN Plus is crushing it right now, and, you know, ESPN is down for more content.
Yeah, I think it was on your show the other day that DC was talking about how 8 of the 10 things on ESPN Plus are MMA related, that is what is driving it. And it goes actually back to the conversation that I think you and I had last time you were on with me, which is, dude, this sport is so conducive to where I think sports fans' attentions are going, that you don't have to invest a ton of time, that it's a one-night-a-week affair, that you can gamble on multiple events, that there's a ton of action, that there are real personalities. It's really digestible, easy to watch, fun, exciting, great content. And honestly, there's a lot of great people who break it down, too, and like yourself and DC, who, make the product better. So I'm not surprised by that. Anyways, that kind of disappoints me. That's kind of where I thought it was going, you were going to say. But I was really, really hoping that you were like, no, they're putting an emphasis and they're stashing some dudes away, and you're going to see some dudes that are like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is a guy. And we're going to see all these dudes with perfect records or whatever, and it's going to be a big deal. So it seems like Dana is really pushing the Habib is going to come back thing. And I don't know. I thought it was a little gauche that he invoked his father in the discussion, that it was his father's dream. I was like, okay, this is a little weird. But either way, it does feel like with them not stripping him of the belt, that it feels at least a little bit more likely that he does come back. And so if Conor McGregor beats Dustin Poirier, do you think it's more likely he comes back for Conor or GSP?
Okay, well, first of all, I do want to say that the Conor-Poirier fight is not a done deal. You may have heard us talking about it on Monday. Mm-hmm. Things are getting interesting. I think it's really interesting the way Dana kind of put it out there. They're like, yeah, I think it's a done deal, when we have to remember, and I know this wasn't your question, but I do think it's important, because sometimes we just take things at face value. We have to remember that the reason why Dustin Poirier versus Tony Ferguson didn't happen in October was because Poirier wanted a better contract. You don't think he wants a better contract for Conor? And let me tell you, he doesn't have a better contract. So I wouldn't be surprised if a switcheroo happens. Could it be Justin Gaethje? Could it ultimately be Dustin Poirier? The one thing that Poirier has in his favor right now is that Conor wants to fight Poirier. Conor likes Poirier. He respects him, all that stuff. And so he has Conor as leverage, but I'm really curious to see how that happens, or if that happens and how it all plays out. But let's just say Conor fights on January 23rd against anyone. Then I think we'll see how, you know, if Conor wins, I don't think we'll see Khabib before the fall of next year, if in fact he returns. Why? Because Ramadan happens in early April, and I don't think if Conor wins, they're going to try everything in their power to do Conor versus Khabib. I don't think in his heart of hearts Dana wants Khabib to fight GSP. I think he feels burned by GSP. He walked away twice. In fact, today is the three-year anniversary of him beating Michael Bisping, and he ultimately vacated that title. So I think he's going to try everything in his power to have Conor fight Khabib. However, if Khabib comes back to him and says, like, hey, man, you want me back? You want me back for number 30? You want all the money that comes with me fighting? I'm only coming back for one guy. Then ultimately, you know, they'll have to explore it. But right now, they've never talked to GSP about the Khabib fight. They've never even, like, broached it with him, and they certainly didn't do it before the fight. They don't have to do it now. And so I think that we'll see what happens on January 23rd, and then I think they'll try to do the Khabib Conor rematch later on in 2021.
Yeah, I guess the case for Poirier would be, hey, okay, you don't have your new contract, but if you somehow beat Conor McGregor now at this point, it changes your star power so much that it is.
It does, though, but here's a guy who's been fighting 10 years. He's been fighting for so long, and he's like, can I cash in at some point? You know what I mean? Like, what more do I have to do? Like, yeah, that's cool. You're telling me that. Great. But can I get some money going into this fight, too? I feel for Dustin. He's always been a company guy. Now he's being labeled as a malcontent. Not fair. But, you know, the UFC train is going to roll along, and they want Conor to come back, clearly. And Conor does big business against anyone. It's not like Conor versus Dustin is the money-making fight. It's Conor versus a broomstick is the money-making fight. Yeah. So he doesn't have a lot of leverage on his side other than Conor saying, no, I only want to fight that guy.
Yeah. No, listen, I was listening to Luke Thomas on Joe Rogan last night as I was trying not to stress out about the election, and listening to him talk about fighter pay and the future of unions and all that stuff. It's a fascinating topic, and it's one that I do. I think that if you're a fan of the sport, you're a fan of the fighters more than just about anything else. And so you hope that guys like Poirier get their due. You root for guys like that. Hey, man, we got to run. It's always great. I appreciate it.
And, we didn't even get to Jan, Izzy, and John Jones. Unbelievable.
I know we didn't. I know.
I took up too much of your time. I'm sorry about that.
I'm disappointed by it because I'm like, I think Izzy's going to walk through Blachowicz, and I know that everyone's going to hype that up like this, but I just think that's an easy one, and it's more curious to me what the fallout of that is once he gets that. Like, does he ever go back down? Does John rethink heavyweight? There's so many fascinating things about Izzy being the two belt champ or the champ that. Yeah,
Champ squared.
Yeah, like I want to see kind of how that feels like it has real significant, shake up potential for the UFC. And so next time, I don't think that story's going away anytime. Just come on again soon.
It's not, and a cheap plug right now on the ESPN MMA YouTube channel. I have brand new interviews with both Izzy and Jan talking about this whole situation, answering some of those questions. So you can go hear from them if you want.
Absolutely love it. Absolutely love it. Always great to chat, man. Let's do it again soon.
All right. Take care. Thank you for having me.
See you, man. It's Ariel Helwani from ESPN. Again, Ariel Helwani's MMA show. DC and Helwani, Ariel and the Bad Guy. All really good content. Always feel a little bit smarter after I listen to them. When we come back, NFL trade deadline was yesterday. I know that a lot of people know that. But nothing really happened. Except for I think that one of my running backs on my fantasy team is hurt, which I'm pretty pissed off. And that some people are mad that they didn't get traded. That's like the bigger story. I'll talk about it with Robert Mays next. Good show on Sportsnet 5-9 of the Fan. Good show on Sportsnet 5-9 of the Fan. I just want to say thank you to the sports gods for always sprinkling just a little bit of something. Again, it's not the thing that matters the most right now, that's for sure. But yeah, just hearing stuff about Vlad Jr., getting that today, Drew Holiday rumors, the NBA, labor dispute stuff. That's good. And yeah, of course, the weirdest of NFL trade deadline days where, yeah, not only was it kind of irrelevant in the news, but it was also pretty quiet. But there was some stuff that didn't happen that I think is pretty interesting. I want to talk about it with our next guest, who's excellent. It's Robert Mays, host of the Athletic Football Show and writer for the Athletic NFL. Hey, Robert, thanks for doing this, man.
Yeah, no worries. It's definitely the most important thing going on. What is living in Toronto like? Is it nice?
It's honestly the best. I love Toronto so much.
All right, maybe I'll put it into consideration here.
Listen, if you follow betting odds, you might be able to stay. It looks a little bit better to stay, but if you need a place, man, like, you know, we got you. Like, we'll be able to figure it out. I'm telling you, you will not.
I'll hit you up.
Especially,
we'll talk
like,
about
you're
it.
A Chicago guy. You're a Chicago guy. You would acclimate to Toronto so quickly. Like, there are a lot of similarities between the two cities.
I actually have been there before, and I do like it a lot. So, I'll file it away for later here.
Perfect, perfect. So, let me just ask you this. Did anything about the deadline surprise you?
No. I think that the lack of movement you probably could have predicted, because the league is just in a different place than it has been over the last couple of years. You know, there's been more action at the deadline and over the past couple of seasons, but you can understand why that's the case, because two things. One, I think that we've really noticed over the last couple of years that there is a market inefficiency when it comes to the certainty of veteran trades. It's good every once in a while to trade a second-round pick for somebody that you know is going to be able to help you right now. That calculus changes a little bit when the cap stops going up. You know, it's been exploding over the past 5 years, at least $10 million every single season. It's going to go down, by potentially $25 million next year. So teams are less willing to say, oh, we'll take on $16 million of Stephon Gilmore's contract in 2021 and figure it out. Oh, absolutely, we're willing to give up a second-round pick for Will Fuller because we could just extend him if it goes well. Those conversations are much different when the cap is going to change as much as it will here over the next year.
Yeah, that does make sense to me. Hey, man, hold on one sec. We're just going to try to reconnect with you because you started to get a little modulated by the end of that answer. So we'll call you back in a second. Yeah, it's, man, everyone that we had on before Robert had basically been telling us that same thing, that they expected a quiet trade deadline day, that the finances were gonna mess with things, that the beyond the acquisition cost of the money and the draft capital, that it was going to be a bit of a trickier deadline and a more quiet deadline. And this actually always happens with the sport. I feel like every single year we talk ourselves into all these trades and you see a deal like Desmond King happens, right? Where there's a guy who you know his name because he's been extremely valuable, or Carlos Dunlap, right? These trades end up happening and you go, oh man, that's a recognizable name that should be able to help this team. And then you see them go for these low prices. Like, again, I think Dunlap went for a backup center and a sixth round pick, and Desmond King goes for a sixth round pick. And I think a lot of fans end up picking up that steam of, oh, well, our team should do something because this is the market, and then why are we not doing something? And then you see something, the reports of Will Fuller being asked for a second when he's only got a year left or half of his contract, and people can't put two and two together. But again, this ends up being very, very much like people predicted. Robert Mays joins us again, host of The Athletic Football Show and writer for The Athletic NFL. So let's just move to the Will Fuller thing, because I always think it's fascinating to see what the guys who were on the block all day, like he did the tweet where it's the little kid tapping his fingers waiting to know if he's going to trade or not. I know Tack McKinley was pissed off that he didn't get traded. I think he actually posted something. I didn't get a chance to read it yet, but apparently the Falcons turned down a second round pick to move him, which I think
is
pretty...
I saw the tweet this morning, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty odd. how do you play those guys the rest? Like, I know that they got to live up to their contract, but now you have to deal with them in your locker room for two teams that aren't really going anywhere. Doesn't it kind of feel like both of those organizations should have maybe just settled for the picks? This is the only oddity to me is, how Houston and Atlanta are justifying these decisions not to lower their asking price.
Well, for McKinley, I think it's going to be a lot more of a conversation just because he seems openly hostile to the situation. With Fuller, I think that's just a fun joke. I mean, I think that I would probably do the same sort of thing if I were my future was hanging in the balance and I had no control over it. I mean, that's probably the lighthearted way to respond to something like that. I think with the difference between somebody like Will Fuller and somebody like Desmond King, for example, I mean, I heard what you were saying before. Desmond King is not in the Chargers' plans. I mean, he was already out of the rotation. It's not as if there's a wait and see game to play with Desmond King. It's certainly possible that the Texans, who are probably going to do a decent amount of retooling next year, whether it's not letting Brandon Cooks go or trying to figure out where they can shed some salary, they may want Will Fuller back on that team next year. So I don't think it's with the Texans. It's a question of a third round or a fourth round comp pick in 2022 or a second round comp pick now where you just let the guy walk. I mean, there's probably a scenario where you figure out an extension for him if certain things break when you get a new GM, all that stuff. So I think that's the difference, is that Will Fuller is actually a part of this team where Desmond King and even Carlos Dunlap were not for Cincinnati and the Chargers.
Yeah, my only problem with that is that Houston, even with Bill O'Brien gone now, feels like they keep painting themselves into these corners where they have to meet the salaries of some of these guys that might not be worth it. Like you saw it with after they made the trade with Miami. It was like, okay, well, now you've just given the player all the leverage because he knows what you've given up to acquire him. And it's kind of the same thing with Fuller now where, all right, I like Will Fuller when he's healthy. He's a good deep threat. He seems to have real chemistry with Watson. But, yeah, the dude does get hurt every year. I said, like, his signature play is catching a deep ball for a touchdown, landing on his collarbone, and then holding his shoulder, and then we don't hear from him for a couple of weeks. Like, that's the Will Fuller experience. And so now, by not trading him and by saying, okay, we're not moving off this guy, okay, well, now you sort of have to pay him or people are going to be pissed off. And now you're kind of out of options. And so, again, it just feels like
you've always
can't
got
catch
the tag, though.
Now. Right.
That's the thing.
I guess.
You've always got the tag. By holding on to guys, you always have that. I mean, that's
true.
The exact same situation that the Bears have with Allen Robinson right now. Mm-hmm. If you're staring down a dispute with a guy on a contract, in the end, you can just give him the tag. And that's the value of holding on to someone, is that even if players seem like they have a decent amount of leverage in these scenarios, for the most part, in the NFL, teams are always going to have more leverage because you can just slap the tag on somebody. And that's always going to be the trump card in these situations.
So I'm going to move off the deadline because, yeah, like nothing happened. I don't think that there's going to be any fan base that's that upset. I don't think that Will Fuller makes the Packers that so much better that this is an outrage for their fan base that they didn't fork over more. I do think that the process was a little interesting, but I wanted to ask you this about quarterbacks, just because Joe Douglas came out and said Sam Darnold is the quarterback of the future, and I've been spending some time thinking about this, especially in reference to the two New York guys, right? Because Daniel Jones is in a similar spot where you just drafted someone, you might have a different GM, you might have a different front office, you don't end up having the guy. But it gets tricky if Trevor Lawrence is sitting there and you end up being one of those organizations that has a chance to pick him and that not moving off for someone who people believe is a, I don't know, I don't want to say generational. I think we throw that term around a little bit too much, but a guy that is unbelievably and heavily coveted. What do you look for when you watch quarterbacks in bad situations?
It's a great question. I think it's hard to parse where the situation ends and where the quarterback begins every once in a while. So I don't know the answer to that. I think that I remember talking to, I think it was Greg Olson, who's now the offensive coordinator for the Raiders, but he was in Los Angeles with the Rams, Jared Goff's first year there. And he said something I thought was really interesting about how much Goff played that year. And he said that when you play a young quarterback in a bad situation for too long, they can develop scar tissue that never goes away. There's only downside when you have to kind of mitigate that with the upside. And I think there's a chance that somebody like Sam Darnold has been in a bad situation for long enough to develop some of that scar tissue. So no matter what your pre-draft evaluation was of him or some of the flashes that he's shown, it's possible that we've already gone too far down a road that he might be hard to salvage. You know, Ryan Tannehill is part of this conversation as well, I think, just because we're talking about changing situations for quarterbacks. But I don't think it was ever that bad in Miami. We're like, oh, I don't know, man. I think this guy's just a lost cause. So I don't know the answer to that. And I think that the question and the mystery around that is going to help define what the asking price is for Sam Darnold this offseason if the Jets end up getting the number one pick and want to go with Trevor Lawrence. Is a team going to feel comfortable giving up a first-round pick for a guy who's been one of the three worst quarterbacks in the league since he's come into the league? Or are we going to have some pre-draft priors where there's one GM that sits there and says, I would have taken this guy in the top five. I'll absolutely give up a second-round pick for him.
Yeah, that's what it goes back to pre-draft stuff. There's a whole bunch of factors that create this. But I just think if you ask the average NFL fan, hey, at the end of the season, if the Giants have to trade Daniel Jones, they'd be like, well, they'll get nothing for Daniel Jones. And yet if you're like, hey, they would trade Sam Darnold, everyone's like, oh, man, you should be able to get a haul back for Sam Darnold. And what if the Patriots trade for Sam Darnold? Or what if the Niners trade for Sam Darnold? I'm like, what has Sam Darnold shown that makes him that much more attractive than Daniel Jones? Like the throw, again, Daniel Jones had a horrible game Monday night, but that throw that he makes to Golden Tate to like almost tie the game. Like, how many of those have we seen from Darnold, right? Like he's been hurt, he's had mono. Yeah, of course it's been Adam Gase. Of course we could debate the weapons, all these different things, but it is interesting to me that there's this like huge discrepancy between those two players in terms of how they're viewed by the vast majority of fans, when I would say that both have had like really, really similar situations.
Oh, I would take it one step further. Josh Rosen's on a practice squad right now.
Yeah.
And he was a top 10 pick.
I didn't even know that he was there.
He's on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers practice squad. And Think about 2 years ago, this is a top 10 pick. And you look at the situations he was in, you couldn't trot out two worse situations than the ones that Josh Rosen had over his first two seasons. That Arizona offense was historically bad with an all-time bad group of players around him. The Dolphins' offensive line last season was one of the worst offensive lines I've ever watched since I started covering the NFL. And now Josh Rosen is just a lost cause? Maybe the answer is yes, but I think it speaks to the conversations that are happening right now about Sam Darnold and Daniel Jones. It's so hard to parse this stuff. And it's why we have guys that have career resurgences, or why guys take chances on highly drafted quarterbacks over and over again, because the egos start to come into play where you say, I'm the one that can save this guy. And I guarantee that if those guys end up going out to the market, there will be some coach somewhere that says that. And I just don't know what the price tag associated with that is.
Yeah. And I will always believe, because I was a Rosen guy, and I believed in the accuracy, but that the likability factor plays a part in him not having a job, or him at least not even being a backup somewhere. We were with the Flyer. Last one on quarterbacks. The Jimmy G thing is really fascinating, because the guy can't stay on the field, and there are the flashes, but there are also the real head scratchers. I don't know if I think that we can all agree that he's not an elite quarterback, that he's not going to be maybe a top 10 guy, but they did just get to a Super Bowl with him. And obviously with that offense, you don't need Russell Wilson. You just need someone who is maybe a little bit above average or competent and can come up with some big plays. But if it's you, if you're at the helm, they come and ask you, hey, what do you think we should do at quarterback next season? And that you can outline just about any different plausible plan. What do you, as just a football fan or someone that wants to see the Niners success, wants to see Kyle Shanahan with a good quarterback, is it run it back with Jimmy G? Is that the riskiest of things? Like, where would you like to see this play out?
I think it would make more sense to try to go with a cheaper option. You know, if Garoppolo is making $15 million instead of $25, I think maybe it's a different conversation. But with the amount he's getting paid and with the returns that you've got, it would make sense just on a football level, I think, to try to find a somewhat cheaper option, because, like you said, you can have a lot of different quarterbacks succeed in that system. The question with the Niners, I think, is more about optics, locker room stuff, than it is about the on-field results. If you give up on a guy or ship a guy out that took you to a Super Bowl a year ago and by all accounts is liked in that locker room and liked in that organization, what does the fallout look like? But on a purely X's and O's football level, I think it would make a lot of sense if they moved on and try to pay a little bit less for a quarterback that could give you the same results.
Do you have any hope of who that would be?
No, because I don't know what the market's going to look like. I mean, do the Vikings just say, let's eat the money with Cousins? I mean, it's an incredible amount of money. I doubt that they end up doing that, but we've seen teams do weirder things when it comes to dead money on quarterbacks and other players, just because cash is king in the league. And if they don't want to pay him $28 million in cash and they say, let's just cut our losses, does Kyle say, bring me Kirk Cousins? Because I think that is certainly on the table based on their history and how much Kyle likes Kirk Cousins. So yeah. I think that it's the same as this offseason. It's like, who knows who's going to be on the market? So yeah. I just feel like there's a lot of guys in that quarterback middle class that might make sense for them that would be able to give you just as much as Garoppolo could for probably a lesser price.
All I know is that it actually is so bad for the Niners this year that me as a Seahawks fan actually feels for them to a certain degree. Like, that's how it's, and now they just, as you were on the phone with us, they have a positive COVID test at their facility, and so they've shut things down, and we're going to see what ends up happening here with their game this weekend. But yeah, oof, what a year for the Niners after coming off of that brutal Super Bowl loss. Robert Mays, host of the Athletic Football Show and writer for the Athletic NFL. Thanks for making time today, man. I always appreciate it.
Absolutely. Talk to you later.
Take care, man. And yeah, let me know if you need a place to stay. I got an air mattress if you got to wait it out a couple of days to find an apartment. Want to save on a hotel room. Yeah, I feel for the Niners. I really think the Niners are great. I hate that I don't like them, because I just really like their team. I really like their coach. I like how they're built. I like their depth. Man, I like just about every unit of that football team outside of the QB when they're healthy. And that's the thing. The only problem I have with it is that everyone keeps drawing the Kirk Cousins thing. And I'm with Robert. I have a tough time seeing the Vikings say goodbye to Kirk Cousins when they just gave him that extension. But again, it's why that extension was so stupid. Why did they do that extension? Why? It's Kirk Cousins. You already paid him all the money. So yeah, could Kirk Cousins go to San Francisco and just be that minor upgrade between Jimmy G and a Super Bowl loss? Like, if you get a guy who can make a couple more plays, and if maybe it is Kirk Cousins, who am I to tell Kyle Shanahan what to look for in a QB? But man, oof, that also doesn't seem so great. And then, like, to me, the Niners would be the most fascinating team to go after Darnold. That if the Jets end up with the first overall pick, and the Niners are sitting there with a decent draft pick and some good capital, like a high second rounder, because their team got completely eviscerated this year. And they said, hey, we'll give you our second and we'll give you beep, boop, beep, a couple of other things that we throw in this deal. Would they look at him? And this is why I'm so curious about what guys look at when it comes to bad quarterbacks, or whether or not they've built up too much scar tissue, or if it makes more sense to have a veteran or a reclamation project for a team that's as close as I think the Niners are when they're healthy. I still think that Darnold, maybe I'm just too fascinated by the potential of upside, and I haven't seen as much bad Darnold on his own as I have seen Kirk Cousins, but if I'm a Niners fan, I would really want something a little bit sexier than Kirk Cousins. Like, the Kirk Cousins thing still presents the same problem that Jimmy Garoppolo does, in the sense of, all right, so the Niners are down 10 and it's the fourth quarter and you got to throw. You need big plays and you need some big plays down the field. Is he scaring you? Is Kirk Cousins the guy that is going to put the pressure on defenses? Like, those end-arounds are cool. Those sweeps are cool. I know you can give the rock to a guy like Deebo Samuel or Mostert, or now that Ayuk kid who looks awesome, and tell them, hey, this is a five-yard. We're going to give you this behind the line of scrimmage, and you're going to take it for a big play. Or we're going to give you a little five-yard slant that we know you have the ability to take it to the house with. But, oof, that's to me is the most interesting situation in football, because I think they're the best team with the worst quarterback ratio. Everyone looks at the Bears and blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, it's them. It's the Niners. What are they going to do? Because if they hit it, if they hit on their quarterback, if they can find that Jimmy G upgrade, which I think is coming, then to me, they're right there with the Chiefs as Super Bowl favorites going in 2020-21. That's the difference right now. Just a slight upgrade. Not blowing that decision, figuring out that decision, and yet it's the most important position. As a Seahawks fan, I hope they blow it. I hope they screw it up. I hope they run back Jimmy G and they talk themselves into the whole thing about his health and blah, blah, blah. But again, I think this is the Bucky Brooks thing, but your best ability is availability. That's the one. And yeah, Jimmy G has had very little availability. And when he has had the availability, I don't know if there's been that much ability. The NBA is in a weird, weird spot. I do not get it for the life of me. There are different scenarios, which I understand. But to me, the first scenario is about as obvious as it gets, especially considering the financial parameters and what we're talking about in terms of extension when it comes to vacation and the guys that actually matter being able to skip some of this stuff. I don't know. Going to talk to Michael Lee and try to figure this out a little bit better with him next. And maybe this will make a little bit more sense. But yeah, from the Washington Post, NBA and Sports Enterprise reporter, it's Michael Lee next on Good Show on Sports 59 of the Fan. Don't think I've talked to our next guest since he booked a new gig. He's one of the best. Michael Lee, Washington Post, NBA and Sports Enterprise reporter. Congrats, man. Haven't wished you it yet.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Hey, Michael, we got you? Hey, no problem, man. No problem.
Yeah,
hey, thanks
I got
for doing this,
yeah,
dude,
I'm here.
And jumping on last minute. We had to shuffle some things around. I appreciate you doing it. And I know that today is a weird day to be talking about sports and that everybody's stressed out and tired. But I'm just going to rapid fire you with a couple of these things because,
hey,
yeah,
you know,
I don't
it's okay
know
to talk about anything else.
Yeah, okay. There's these two scenarios that are being floated around with the NBA. And I can't for the life of me understand how the players would be rationalizing the idea of a January start, the 60-game option, knowing what we know about the loss of revenues that, you know, are in the billions of dollars at this point, knowing that you would ignore the extra hundreds of millions that could come in just for a few extra weeks off. What am I missing here? What are fans missing here?
Who just won the championship? Who's the
okay,
face of the league?
So that's it?
Yeah. Who played well into October? I mean, he holds a lot of power, and I mean, I think the reason why there was a bubble in the first place and why the league was so adamant about getting one created in Orlando was because they had LeBron's influence behind it. I mean, he wanted to have it done so that he could get that championship. You know, he was with a team that had a chance to go all the way, and I think that, you know, his involvement, his kind of behind-the-scenes push to make it happen, made it happen. And I think right now, I mean, he just won, and it seems kind of unfair to, you know, play a bubble, have your body on a weird kind of fastball clock, and then all of a sudden, like 2 months later, say, let's do it all over again. I mean, and he's up in age. I mean, he's 36. He'll be 36 and, at the end of the year. So, I mean, that's a lot to ask of him to come back and then try to carry the league again, you know, after doing it in the bubble. So, I mean, there's a lot of factors involved, but I think that the fact that you just had a championship and then you try to go and have a quick turnaround to players who, you know, had deep playoff runs, it just seems unfair. But you also got to take consideration there were eight teams that didn't play at all, haven't played since March. So you got to take them in consideration, too, when you try to plan this out. So I think in the end, players will eventually realize that playing 72 games financially is better than playing 60. And, you know, whatever revenues, you know, they have to try to make sure they get the revenues. And whatever rest they may need, they just have to make it up during the season.
Yeah, so that makes a lot of sense to me. And I guess if we're reading between the lines here, that as much as LeBron James does have a voice, and as much as guys like Pat Beverly, when he said the thing about what LeBron James aside we do when it came to playing in the bubble, that, yeah, eventually the numbers are probably going to side to the 72 games and the extra money. But, man, I guess it's weird with LeBron because, yes, you're right, it's not fair. Nothing's fair right now with the pandemic. Of course he wants to be able to soak this in, but do you think that this maybe changes his opinion on load management? Because before he seemed a little bit critical of Kawhi Leonard and the way that he handled things. Now his team has won. They would enter this quick turnaround. If we do see the 72-game season, do you think that we end up seeing a very, very different LeBron James in terms of the way he's managed? Because his usual style has been he manages it in-game while still playing.
Yeah, I think that the one thing that people have missed when it comes to LeBron and load management is that, you know, at this stage in his career, LeBron doesn't have games to give away. I mean, he can't load manage if he's trying to catch Kareem for the all-time lead scorer. I mean, that's what right. I'm always amused when people talk about that. LeBron's playing for something bigger than just trying to, you know, lead his team to a title or whatever. He wants to go down as the best to ever do it. And one of the ways to do that is that you finish as the top scorer. You finish top five assist guy. You can't do that if you miss games. I mean, you look at Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Karl Malone, the guys right now who are 1 and 2, their durability and longevity is why they're the top two scorers right now in the league. And those are the only two guys he's looking up to. I think Karl Malone may have missed two games like three times in his career. I mean, like, you got to play every game if you're going to be putting numbers on the board like that. And who knows how long he'll be playing at this level. It doesn't seem like he'll ever stop playing at this level, but eventually he's going to decline. And right now, while he's still at his peak, he can't give away these games when he's still able to put up monster numbers. So I think unless LeBron doesn't feel like he can play at that elite level, I think he'll continue to try to play every game he can.
So play-ins for the 7 through 10 seeds are there in either scenario. Can we assume these are locked in forever and that the only thing is how creative they get with those games moving forward?
Yeah, I think the bubble it made it so exciting. You know, the fact that you had that sort of play-in thing with the last 8 games, I think that brought a little buzz and excitement. And I think the league realized that was a way to sort of turn those last couple weeks of the regular season into something that people care about as opposed to just kind of just dragging into the playoffs. So I think that's something that's going to be here to stay. The players are excited about it. I think it's going to be weird, you know, years where you're going to find teams that are going to be fighting for the 10th spot, you know, just to get in and as opposed to the 8th spot to play in the playoffs. But I think that something like that, it played out so well. And the league is always willing to try new things. If something works, there's no need to walk away from it.
Yeah, I hope that they adopt the Elam ending for those games. Like that they just go full tilt, like, hey, this is very different. We're going very modern with this. We'll never have Elam ending for games that are outside of this, but since they're already these weird games that don't fit in the category of a regular season game or a playoff game anyways, let's just get, like I said, just get more innovative, push it even further forward. So we're already starting to see trade rumors, right? Like, there's no real free agent class. I know that Toronto, everybody cares about what happens because Serge Ibaka, Marc Gasol, and Fred VanVleet are all free agents. But for the most part, it's not very deep. Yeah, exactly. No, Fred VanVleet's a real free agent, and that's legitimate. But outside of him, it kind of, you start to look at it, and I think I've seen lists that have Christian Wood, who's a fine player, but I've seen him in a top five free agents this offseason. So it's like, yeah, it's pretty thin. But now we're starting to see names like Drew Holiday popped up today, and there's the Morey is interested in James Harden thing, which everyone mocked because, yeah, of course, everyone would be interested in James Harden. What does that actually mean? But are you anticipating that there's going to be a bunch of movement here once we actually lock up the season date? Because it's starting to feel like there's real momentum for that.
Yeah, I think that was always going to be the case because there are going to be a lot of haves and have-nots. There are going to be teams that feel like they lost a lot of revenue this year because of the pandemic, and they'll be looking at the expensive players on their roster and saying, how can I get out of this? And they'll just start dumping players off to the teams that have money and don't care. So I think you're going to see some movement because some teams are just going to be like, let's just count our losses and start all over. And some teams are going to be like, well, we'll take him, gladly take him, so we can try to make a run for a title because the league's going to be wide open again. So you're going to see the teams that are in contention and have opportunities to go for it, making huge gambles, especially when you realize the Miami Heat and the Lakers both got to the finals after going to the lottery the year before. So now more than ever, you got to really go for it when you have a chance, and I think there'll be a lot of movement.
Man, I can't wait, because especially since it's coming when there's not going to be a lot of sports, and who knows what ends up even happening with football over the next little bit here. But do you think Morey is going to be splashy? Like, do you think that he'll actually step in there right away day one and try and push out one of that team's biggest names without giving them an opportunity to have one more year under him and under Doc Rivers and a different coaching staff?
I think they want to see what they have. I think that, you know, if people look at what Morey did the last 8 years with James Harden. Well, James Harden was the only star that he had, so he had to try to do whatever he could to build a team around him, and that meant gambling for Dwight Howard and gambling for Chris Paul and Russell Westbrook. But he has two foundational stars already in place. I think everything now will be kind of built around the margins and just try to build a complete roster that can, complement the talents of their stars. You got to remember, when Daryl Morey first took over, he had Yao Ming and Tracy McGrady, and he tried to build a team that worked with them, and they got close, but they always had to deal with injuries to their two main stars. If their two stars can stay healthy, I can see him sort of sticking to the philosophy that he had before, where he's just trying to build the right team based on the talents that he has, as opposed to just sticking to one particular style of play.
Hey, man, again, I know it's a weird day, and I know that you got to run, and I appreciate you jumping on last minute. Thanks for coming through for us, Michael. Always great, man.
No worries. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Take care, man. It's Michael Lee from the Washington Post, NBA and Sports Enterprise reporter. I don't see a better trade idea than simply trying to give Ben Simmons for James Harden and then working whatever else you need to do to make the money work, but having those two guys be the central figures and take the two guys that really seem to complement each other. Like James Harden, pick and roll maestro with Joel Embiid would scare the living crap out of me. And that actually replicates a lot closer to the Yao Ming, Tracy McGrady example that Michael outlined. Like, that people put Daryl Morey in this box of, hey, this is what he does and this is how he does it, because this is what he did around James Harden. But yeah, I don't think that he's just someone who necessarily wants everyone to be small. Joel Embiid's maybe the best defender in the NBA when he's healthy. He's at least on a very, very short list. Don't think that he would necessarily just want to be getting rid of that guy. But either way, I'm buoyed by a couple of things when we're looking at the non-sports horizon for the next little while. And again, it's not even non-sports. We already got all these reps in a reality where there actually were none in the pandemic, and we were waiting for the odd UFC card to come back and Bundesliga, and now we actually do have Champions League. We do have the NFL. It really does feel like basketball is going to return faster than we anticipated. And again, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of losses in a CBA where guys split it 50-50. I don't think that the majority of players are going to side with LeBron. And that was always my suspicion, which is Michelle Roberts and her comments, the leader of the NBA Players Association, has been speaking for a small group of powerful NBA players when it comes to startup time. And that these guys who are already deep pockets and are playing for legacy stuff like LeBron James, that it makes sense for him not to come back right away. He's fine. He's got his Space Jam money. He's got his millions of dollars. He's not worried about – he's more concerned about the extra month. He's one of the guys that would do that. The rest of the players, doubt it. Doubt they're going to look at those financial repercussions and say it's fine. But the things that buoy me, one is that the NBA offseason, I think, is going to be big. I think that it's going to be compact, and that general managers who have not been able to make a move for over a year, think about when the last offseason was. It's been over a year. It's November. I know it doesn't feel like November at times, unless it's, you know, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Then it feels very November-y. But from a sports fan standpoint, it does not feel like November. And then you take into account that these teams have been sitting on their hands idle for over a year to actually make significant moves, and that there is not a big free agent class, that you cannot go out there and solve your free agent problems, and also that you have this 2021 class looming where you can change the outcome of your franchise drastically, and you want to be able to either set yourself up for that or take advantage of the teams that are trying to set themselves up for it. And it all leads me to believe that, hey, the next couple of weeks here, it's just going to happen fast and furious. All of a sudden, we're going to have a free agency period where that date opens up, and we're going to have player transactions, and we're going to have movement, and you are going to see some teams get hyper-aggressive. You are going to see the likes of the Milwaukee Bucks say, we are no chance rolling it back with the same team that got obliterated, even when Giannis was healthy, to the Miami Heat. There is no chance that the Clippers say, hey, we had a bad break against Denver, and we are just going to do it like this. There's no way that teams like Denver or Utah are not going to get creative and try to say, we got to take advantage of this. We got to make sure that our young stars are happy. We can win. Why not us? There's so many teams. Remember how wide open it felt? I think it's going to be the same thing. And yeah, the Lakers kind of changed that prospect. But again, LeBron James is older, and the quick turnaround time, AD always being kind of a bit of an injury concern, that team having trouble finding some depth. I don't know. I think it's going to be exciting. I'm really, really excited to see what's going to happen. I think there's going to be a ton of moves, and I think that there's going to be bigger names that move than we think. And even the idea of a Jrue Holiday, like, that's a really, really good player. It's a really, really good player. Please let me see a cool Jrue Holiday move. And I do wonder how this all impacts Fred VanVleet, right? Because if there's a lot of guards on the market and you could be trading for a Jrue Holiday, let's say you're the Knicks and you can just acquire Jrue Holiday and, I don't know, maybe not have to give up very much because New Orleans is just looking to move off of him and they're trying to pivot. They're trying to go with a different direction. If you're the Knicks, do you just get involved in that and say, hey, we can get him and he's, I don't know, he's at least as good as Fred VanVleet. He's a little bit older, but the age gap is not that significant. Makes a lot more money, but I don't know. Fred VanVleet could get 20-plus, $20 million. Would you rather have Jrue Holiday for nothing and maybe even an asset back? Or would you rather have Fred VanVleet? I don't know. It could be a destination point that evaporates for Fred based on this, that it could end up actually becoming a little bit more favorable for the Raptors. Either way, going to be fun, and we need it right now. We need it in sports because the NFL is going to be good, but this is kind of the lull period in the NFL, I will say. These couple of weeks before, I would say like week 13, week 12, when it starts to heat back up again and playoff races become significant and a lot more real, and you get close to your fantasy football finals and all that different stuff. Hockey seems a million years away, and same with baseball, which we have a slow moving off season where we'll be able to talk about a lot of stuff because the Blue Jays are interesting, but that you got to believe it when every single person that has any knowledge of the market is saying it's going to take a while and that they're going to see and that there's not going to be a rush to spend money and that even teams with money that could go out and get a little splashy like the Blue Jays are still not going to be the ones who rush out to set it. Anyway, let's go NBA. Let's go NBA offseason. Draft. 2 weeks from now, I think the draft is. Masters. Oh, it's good. It's fine. Everything is fine. Everything is golden. It's just a little dark, and we get a nice week here. When we come back, my favorite thing happened the other day. Well, it's one of my favorite things that can possibly happen. on Odds and Ends. That's next. Good show. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I wish I could just declare things like Trump and just say things like I've already said that that Good Show has the highest ratings out of any sports radio show in the country. Actually, in the United States too, I declare it's the biggest sports program. It's the biggest sports radio program, and I should be paid accordingly. I declare this. As far as I'm concerned, Good Show is the most popular show in all of sports. Television, radio, whatever. You name it, it's the most popular one. As far as I'm concerned. It's Good Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm J.D. Bunkus. No Benny this week. He'll be back next. I'm definitely off Friday. I got to get a wisdom tooth pulled. I'm not really stoked about it. Not fired up. I don't know when I'll be back with it. Again, they keep telling me different things about what's going to happen. With my ability to speak. But one of my favorite things happened. I said it going into the break. Nothing excites me more than clicking a link where it's Criminal X tried to get one over professional fighter Y. You know? Where it's, oh, this guy was on a train and he tried to mug a lady, and then it turned out that there was a UFC fighter that was on that train. Or this guy tried to break into this MMA guy's car, and then all of a sudden he realized it was an MMA fighter, and then guess what happened? The results were predictable, right? And it's so good. I get so excited. I cannot wait. Because, man, you see UFC fighters fight each other. You see Jon Jones fight a fighter, a Lyoto Machida, and he chokes him out standing up. He puts him in the graveyard. You see Khabib Nurmagomedov fight the best three lightweights I have seen in my lifetime. Maybe not, except for Tony Ferguson. And guess what? Body bag, body bag, body bag. Go get the body bags. Because that's what he does to those guys. So you can guess how excited I got when I saw that someone tried to break into John Jones's place. That John Jones, there was some robber. I think he lives in Arizona or New Mexico, one of the two. I think it's New Mexico. So John Jones, there's this robber. They have security cam footage. It was disappointing, but someone tried to break into John Jones's home or one of his vehicles, and then he chased that person with a shotgun. And he said, like, hey, lucky for this person that I wouldn't shoot someone who's retreating and blah, blah, blah. But John Jones with a shotgun over anybody on the planet with anything. You can have a tank. I'm taking John Jones with a shotgun. Because, man, if he gets inside that tank, like, it's game over for you. John Jones shouldn't even be allowed to have guns because he's just such a danger as he is. But could you just imagine the fear of, you know, you muster up the courage to go break into somebody's car. You do it. You put your hood over and you sneak over and you get your little, I don't know, hanger. Whatever it is, you try to scoop in there, go underneath, pop the lock. If you can even do that, you can't really even do that with new cars. I'm old. And then all of a sudden, you hear a dog barking, and then you look over your shoulder, and it's John freaking Jones. You're like, ugh, this is going to suck. Maybe it's better because he might not shoot you because he knows he can beat your ass, and so you're just going to take the worst beating of your life, but you'll live, maybe. Maybe it's actually better to break into an MMA guy's place. It's like he's not going to kill you because he knows his own strength. Or she knows her own strength. But either way, God, I love it. I'm always so here for it. I'm sorry because I don't mean to make light of these people who are being obviously afraid and they're victims of a crime. But yeah, I want to see criminals get instant justice, karmic justice instantly. And that is breaking into John Jones's place. And then, hey, you know, who wouldn't watch? Remember the show Shaq Verse? Or like Pros versus Joes? Who wouldn't watch, like, hey, steal John Jones's money? If you can break into John Jones's house and get out alive, you get some of his stuff. But if he catches you, he gets to just basically do whatever he wants. I would watch that show. I would like to pitch that show. I feel like that's a possibility in the reality we live in right now, that we could have a show like that. Anyways, get at me, Sportsnet executives, if you want to have my idea. I'm back tomorrow. Plenty more. Oof, stay safe out there. Try to stay calm. I don't know. Well, however you relax, try and do that. Just walk away from the TV. It's nice outside. Get out. Talk to you tomorrow.